What up, everybody? Welcome to the Smoking Tire Podcast. This episode is brought to you by RaceChip. They're back. RaceChip offers plug-and-play performance upgrades for factory turbocharged and supercharged cars. Here's the thing. With a forced induction car, the factory leaves something on the table. You can unlock that at home with something like a RaceChip. You can get a healthy increase in power and torque, sometimes up to 30%. You can also get better miles per gallon. Yes, that's what tuning does. It's made in Germany. You know it's going to be good quality. They've got great testing over there. They've got TÜV approval, which means that RaceChip is approved by a body for use on the street that is more stringent than here in the U.S. Every tune is tested with more than 30 dyno runs per vehicle. They have 100 car enthusiasts working in there to improve RaceChip's product every day, and they have more than 500,000 customers. RaceChip is super easy plug and play installation. It's like 15 minutes. It's really easy. The manuals are on YouTube, and all the engine protection mechanisms remain active because it doesn't modify the ECU itself. Very easy to go back to stock, and there's a 5-year warranty and a 30-day money back guarantee. Hit up RaceChip Chip Tuning on Instagram. You see, in Europe, tuning is called chip tuning. That's why it sounds a little weird. Tuning is called chip tuning there, so it's like race chip chip tuning. It sounds a little weird, but that's how you remember it. It's chip chip in the middle. Race chip chip tuning. Then on YouTube and Facebook, of course. And if you want to increase the power of your car in a healthy way, hit up Race Chip for quality from Germany. Go to racechip.us. That's racechip.us and use code SMOKINGTIRE to get 10% off your order, limited to one tune per customer. RaceChip.us, code SMOKINGTIRE for 10% off. And guys, how about that Brio Beardscape joint, bro? I've actually had a couple people thank me publicly on the YouTube comments for turning them onto the Beardscape. You know why? Because it's a beast, and they know it. When they try it, they're like, oh, Farrah wasn't just reading that script. It actually is a beast. I just used it. It's weird. I used it right before I read the last ad, and that's because I use it once a week. And I read the ads on Fridays. That's when I shave. Everyone owns a trimmer, and most of them are terrible. Most people you talk to won't be like, man, I love my trimmer, but I love my Beardscape. It's got this ceramic blade that stays sharper longer than a stainless steel blade. It also requires less care and oiling because it won't rust, folks. It's got a beast of a battery with a really clear display showing you how much is left, so you never get caught off guard by a dead battery. This battery, for me, it goes like a year. If you shave every day, it won't go a year, but if that's like 50 to 60 shaves for me is a year. It's quiet, it's powerful, it charges overnight, and then it lasts for a year. It's light, it's very portable, comes in a great case. Guys, it's time to upgrade to the Beardscape. Go to brio4life.com. That's B-R-I-O, the number 4, life.com. Brio4life, code SMOKING at checkout. Brio4life gets you the best price on the internet. Brio4life.com, code SMOKING. How about that Auto Tempest, John? You might notice Zach's been using AutoTempest.com on the show to show vehicles. That's because we love Auto Tempest. It searches all the sites at once, people. There are so many sites out there. People are always starting new ones. Everyone's always got a brand new idea for what the best, like, car selling site needs to be. Here's the thing, guys. You don't need to make one that is the best. You need to make one that looks at all of them. That's what Auto Tempest does. It looks at all the car sites at once, so you only have to type in your search criteria one time, therefore saving you time, therefore saving you money. That's how it is. It's autotempest.com. I use it if I'm browsing for a car. I use it if I want to see what the market's doing. And I use it if I'm looking for something specific because it saves me time and saves me money. At autotempest.com, they are our homies. We love them. Please use them. Thank you. Lastly, so your check engine light comes on. You know, what are you going to do? Step one, you grab a Blue Driver Pro scan tool. Why? Why do that? Because it gives you knowledge. It gives you education. You don't even really need to know anything to get the scan tool. All you do is plug it in to the port in your car, And this tells you in regular terms what the problem is, and it suggests solutions from a database of millions of ASE certified verified fixes. ASE certified verified fixes. That's a funny wording. Then you can fix the problem yourself, or you can head to the garage armed with knowledge. Either way, you're in control. Plus, Blue Driver can do so much more than just read codes. You can view live data from your vehicle, read a freeze frame and a mode 6, do a smog check. Not a certification, you can't do that, but you can see, you can save time and see if your car is going to pass smog, and stay up to date on recalls and service bulletins and much more. It's like having a little electronic technician living in your drawer. And that's why Blue Driver is the best-selling scan tool on Amazon. Go over there and read those reviews, apparently by real people, so they say. For a limited time, take advantage of the Smoking Tire offer. Visit bluedriver.com/TST to get 10% off the Blue Driver Pro scan tool. Don't let your car troubles be a mystery again. Get Blue Driver today and get 10% off the Blue Driver scan tool at bluedriver.com/TST. All right, folks, on this episode of the podcast, I'm in studio with Vinny Russo. I have been on the road for the last 2 weeks driving 13 different cars. Vinny went on the road to buy back his old Cadillac that he had sold a couple of years ago, and now he's got it back. We've got construction updates, and we're basically going through all that stuff. And also, I haven't really done a show since Carl died, so we're probably going to end up talking about Carl, because I just did that little intro last time. And a lot of good things. I mean, other than Carl actually dying, but there's been a lot of love. It's been great. And so that's been comforting. All right, me and Vinny in studio. It's the Smoking Tire Podcast.
It's the motherfucking Smoking Tire Podcast. We live. I have been on the road for 2 entire weeks, and so we really haven't done a real show in a while. Vinny Russo in the studio.
What up?
Fresh off the return trip, buying back his old Cadillac. Now that is delightful.
That's cool.
Get us a picture of the fucking 65. That is it, 65 or 66?
65. Yeah.
It's a 65. Yeah. The Vinny's Cadillac is so Vinny. Like, this is the most. It's the most Vinny Russo car, because it really, it's tasteful, but it really brings out your Florida-ness.
And with a hint of Guido.
With a hint of Guido and a slice of Goomba, and a hint of as you drop it on the bags.
Yeah.
Tell the people who aren't looking at the photo about your Cadillac.
It's a white 65 Calais, which is basically, it's a two-door version of the Coupe de Ville. So I had bought
it's the same length as the four-door version.
It's 2 inches longer than a Chevy Suburban, but it's a two-door. So that, if you want to picture that, I think the mic guesstimated the quarter panels are about 8 feet long.
Is it shorter or longer than the Daytona?
It's actually, that was one of the things Mike was looking at. It's actually a little bit longer than the Daytona.
Is it?
Yeah, the Daytona
actually longer?
Yeah, the Daytona is exactly like a little over 200 inches, and this is a little over that.
I think the Daytona was like 202.
Yeah. Yeah, this is longer than that.
I saw it because Vinny brought it back.
It wouldn't fit in his garage, and the Daytona fits in his garage.
And it won't fit in my garage. I mean, it will.
It will, but
it turns my 4-car garage into a 3-car garage. It takes up more than half. Like, at Westside, like, it needs a tandem.
It might need a
tandem. I actually don't know if it'll fit on the racks, although I'm hoping you drive it enough that we won't have to put it
on
the racks.
No, I'm going to drive it a lot. That's the whole thing is this car. It's not a show car. It's a good 10-footer. It's original. I mean, it's 54 years old, and it's all, other than the bags and the wheels that I got from Detroit Steel Wheels, Ride Tech bags. Everything else is there, and it all works. So is it stock?
Like, so I pulled up. This is a stock one.
Yeah, it's a stock one.
And so it's profile shot. Gives you a little more of the length.
The length, yeah.
It's so long.
Look at the trunk.
It's so long. And also yours. I mean, holy shit! Do the wheels make a difference?
Huge difference.
Yeah. The wheels make an extraordinary, and the height. I mean, it's at the right stance.
Solid 8-body trunk.
That's delightful. I went back in the day. Me and Hannah went to dinner with Vinny in this. We went to go buy the Million Mile Lexus in Florida, and man, you roll up to dinner in this. It's fucking fire, this thing.
Yeah, there is all the shows that I go to, that no matter where you bring that car, it just stops traffic.
It's so very,
sure.
I bought it a few years ago, and I sold it to Big Chris from Gas Monkey Garage, because
I don't know if the audience knows Big Chris.
Yeah,
do the audience know Big Chris?
I don't know.
Big Chris is from England,
yeah,
and was like a huge Mopar drag racer in the UK.
Which is odd, but he was, yeah.
Yeah, and he owned a very famous car, too. Didn't he own that Napa car?
Yeah.
I think he owned the Napa... What was the... Can you find the
Challenger,
Napa drag... Napa drag car...
and he recently relocated to
Blue. I don't remember what was it, but sorry.
He moved to Dallas, and he's working with. If you watch Gas Monkey Garage, he's the big, tall, goofy looking guy with the English accent. Every once in a while, he'll do a cameo on the show once in a while.
Oh, and, speaking of fucking Richard, by the way, as happens. So you know what happens is we record this show typically.
Yeah,
we have conversations. We go home, I completely forget what we talked about, and then like 3 weeks later, my Twitter blows up with some shit, and I go, What is this even about? Well, we were talking about the Thomas Crown Affair. I don't know if you were here.
No.
And the Thomas Crown Affair Mustang. Do you remember when he goes to his private island and there he has a safari
Mustang.
Shelby GT500?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's the original one, but
Richard's got a duplicate of it.
He built a replica.
Yeah, a while ago, actually.
Cool.
Yeah.
He's had
that car for a really, really long time.
Yeah.
Back when we did the bull run with him, he actually still had that car.
Did he really? Yeah. Has it been that long?
That was pre-Gas Monkey Garage.
I didn't realize he's had it for that long. It is the coolest.
Yeah, it's really, if you ever get out to Dallas, between him and Dennis Collins' cars, you really need to take a look. Not just the Gas Monkey stuff, but like Dennis's personal cars and Richard's personal cars. They got some cool stuff there.
Richard has surprisingly good taste, actually. in stuff. He really does. I know that people don't like that black F40 they did, but I thought, like, considering they started with a straight crashed car.
Why not? Yeah.
Or the
bagged Ford GT. Everybody was like, oh my God, I can't believe you do that.
But I wouldn't. I mean, that's definitely a look. This is, bro, Zach, pull that picture over. I mean, is there a better GT500 in the world than a fucking caged convertible Safari GT500 with some fucking big ass KCs on the bar?
So good.
And a spare on the trunk lid.
If that doesn't give Richard street cred, I don't know what will.
I mean, that's that is just the best, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ugh. So, whose phone is that? Fucking Russo.
I thought I turned it off.
I thought, we always thought you turned it off, but you didn't.
I did not.
You didn't. Right. But yeah, so that's fucking cool. So Big Chris bought your Cadillac.
Big Chris bought it. It wouldn't fit in my garage in Florida. It was getting ruined. Even with the $700 CarCraft cover I put on it, it was still the salt air was starting to kind of get to it a little bit, and I didn't want it ruined. Chris bought it. Him and his wife picked it up in Florida, drove it to Dallas over 4 days, and had it there for a couple of years, and he just really wasn't using it. Sold it to another friend of his in Chico, which is just north of Sacramento. And that guy picked it up, and then he drove it from Dallas up there. So this car is literally driven cross-country with absolutely zero issues. I picked it up. Between driving it down to Musto's house and then back down home, was another 600 miles I put on it on Sunday.
But did you pick it up, turn the key, and just drive it home, and that was it?
Yeah. It did absolutely nothing to it.
How many miles are on it now?
111.
How many did you sell it with?
102.
Oh, okay. That's good.
Yeah, so 3,000 of that was cross-country.
So what does it need anything now?
I'm going to go through and update a couple of things. Like, I was going to talk to your friends over at AccuAir and see about updating the electronics
Dude, call up Reno at AccuAir, dude.
So I've got the phone app stuff they do. Yeah, I mean, I've got like I got a regular switch box for the airbag, so I don't have all the fun electronics that AccuAir can do, so I thought about doing that. And then Mob Steel is going to give me some updated artillery wheels, because those wheels that are on that car are actually the very first Detroit Steel wheels that were available to the public. I got the very first set, so time to update it for a little bit new style. And other than that, I'm just going to pimp the hell out of it all
what,
over.
What's the new wheel look like? Is it on Detroit Steel's website?
Yeah, it's a steel wheel, but it's got a little bit of a cutout around the edge. Mm-hmm. Just little notches, give it a little bit of more of a look instead of a smooth steel.
Can you stick with black?
Yeah. Black with the chrome.
Black's good. Yeah, the black with the chrome. I would say like you could also do the kind of like the color of it's the middle one.
Well, that they have the which I don't know which one's that's the artillery. There's a different one with little squares, not quite wagon wheel as looking, but there's another one with little squares. That's
you could also do it like a dark gray.
Yeah,
and that
the interior
would work.
Of the car is blue. So, but
you could also do blue. I mean, you could actually.
I have a picture of one with it done in blue with chrome. It's not.
I think if it was a powder coat blue and it was not super blingy, it could really
dark,
work.
Dark blue, maybe. What color is the interior?
Like a seafoam green blue.
No, it's you wouldn't. Yeah,
no, it's not.
It's not seafoam green.
It's not royal blue. It's a lighter blue.
If you could picture that Cadillac GM blue leather from the 60s, pretty common color. Yeah, it's fucking nice though. It's a great driver.
It's just a cool car, just to drive. I can take it out, not worry about somebody
digging
it. How to
do it with the ramp?
Fine. Yeah, I actually I was by myself, so I couldn't videotape it, but I ran it down the ramp completely. Because honestly, you know why I ran it full low? I don't want to open that gate all the way.
As low as I
could get the car, so I didn't have to open the gate any more than I had to.
There's a story there. So construction update. It's going like really well over there at construction, but the gate to the basement. It's got a fucking gate.
And security
it's
gate. Security gate. Thick ass, heavy ass security gate.
But we don't have like power yet. And so, we have power that we're like tapped into the fucking utility poles for lights and stuff, for construction lights and tools. But I don't have real power. Like in a couple of weeks, they're actually digging up the street to give me power because they have to run it underground.
Yeah.
And the gate is meant to have an electric motor. It's no big deal, except it's not connected yet, so it has a hand chain that's like a emergency backup.
The ratio is about like a 5-foot pole down is about a quarter of an inch movement at best.
Dude, I timed it last night. I had to open it high enough to get like
a
Cayenne in there, and it took me about 2 minutes and 40 seconds
of straight pulling
to open it enough to get a Cayenne.
That gate's heavy, so it's got to be geared so low because that gate's so heavy.
That's crazy.
It's like
So really Vinny driving under the gate with the caddy fucking slammed is actually quite a practical thing to be doing.
The other practical thing with airbags on that is it's really hard to steal the car or steal the wheels because you can't get a jack underneath it. So I had a lot of friends back in Florida and South Florida that they were bagging their trucks when the 24s got big just because you couldn't steal them.
Just drop
They're
it on
just
the frame.
Sitting
drop
it on the
frame.
In the fender.
Yeah, sitting in the fender well on the frame. You'd have to break into the car, figure out how the air ride works, and to steal the wheels, and you just couldn't do it. So.
That's funny. That'd be a security feature for like the air ride companies. You're just like, if you can't use the app that's on your phone, you can't lift the car up.
Can they tow you either?
Not really, it'll just drag frame.
I mean, they'd fuck the car right up if they tried.
Yeah,
I bet
they,
some vindictive
they
tow guy would probably get personally offended.
I honestly don't think you could boot that car either because I've got the covers over the back wheels. It's got
the spat?
Yeah.
Well, you could boot the front. You only have to boot one.
Yeah, but low, I don't even think you can get a boot in between the front fender.
Maybe not.
I don't know if you can.
It would be close. I'd like to see someone try. Who's got a boot? Let's bring it by. Let's do it.
But anyway, so that was fun. I had a really good time.
Went
to go see Musto, and he bought some new toys. I got to see all his stuff. And
he bought that Bronco, didn't he? He bought a Bronco?
He bought a Bronco.
He bought a black Bronco.
OJ-style Bronco, but black.
It was pretty good. He sent me a picture of it. Is it on his Instagram yet?
No, I don't think so.
Why not?
Because he's not done with it yet.
It fucking should be.
Yeah.
It was a nice, like, was it 90-something?
Yeah, late 90s.
Late mid-90s. And it was great, except it had them stupid, ugly chrome wheel arch things on it.
Yeah, which is easy enough to take off.
Is it on his Instagram yet, Zach?
I think so.
No.
Aww.
What the fuck?
But we got a better front shot of
Vinny's
car.
That's a better shot of the car, of Vinny's car. Yeah, that car looks so great.
Me and Tannis driving back.
That's all the car needs. It needs to sit right and have some good wheels. You don't need to do anything else.
No, that's
it's amazing how much dropping it just like... with these are like the dog dish kind of hubcaps and white walls, like, all right. I mean, it's got such cool shape. It's like really great presence.
Yeah.
It's so big.
It's so big.
It's like you don't see these a lot in L.A. because they're so impractical. But
now I averaged 9 miles per gallon on the way home.
It's also why you don't see them very much
anymore.
Did you? Yeah, that's terrible.
What was your cruising speed?
About 85-90.
Really?
Yeah.
85-90?
Yeah. Oh, the car will do... I've had it up to 110. That's about the fastest I'll ever push that thing.
That's fucking sketch.
but usually I could cruise at like 90, 80, 89, depending on the traffic and stuff like that. We took the 101 back and just kind of chilled, but... With the gas prices going up, somebody asked me the gas. Well, what do you get mileage on that? I'm like, some.
Yeah.
What brakes are on it?
Still drum brakes, but that's actually first on my list here. There's a place here in LA that specializes in conversions for discs, so I'm going to drop it off next week. I'm taking it to the PEC event, the Porsche Experience Center, this weekend.
Oh yeah, we're going to go out there on Saturday.
And then next week I'm going to drop it off and get the drum brakes done.
Is it? Do they just use like probably something off like a modern pickup truck or something, right? Some basic ass GM
they do,
shit.
They
right?
do a spindle and a conversion over new, you know, all new front end stuff. But it basically swap the spindle out and do disc
brakes. That's gonna change the game.
Well,
feels so much safer.
Because if you've ever driven drum brakes, it's like, oh, we don't know which direction it's going.
Yeah.
Or when it will stop.
Yeah. You get one good stop out of it, and after that, it's heated up and you can't do anything.
Yeah, but that just sucks in traffic. You don't deal with that bullshit. You need real brakes. Do they use the same like master cylinder and stuff too?
Yeah, I have to add a power booster to it, It's not hard at all. Air conditioning works in that car. I mean, everything works.
That's great. Yeah, that's great.
I'm excited to have it back.
He got that cat.
Family
back.
That's cool.
Back.
That's really cool.
The guy had it from that orange truck.
No, that's the guy who had it.
Yeah. So that had a 440 in it, and
this is like a Dodge pickup that's just slammed on like NASCAR wheels.
The front end had a Supra front end grafted into it.
Whoa.
The front coilovers, A arms, and everything is all from a Supra on the front end of that.
Oh, I miss hot rodding.
Why Supra? What was he doing?
Ride quality.
Really?
It fit in there perfect, and he grafted the whole front end from a Supra on there, and it fit right where the frame was.
Like a Mark IV Supra?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Not a Mustang 2 front end.
Had coilovers on it and everything. It was
so
awesome.
So when you do something like that, do you then use a Supra like steering column and chat? Like do you get the entire thing out of a Supra?
You have to do a specific, you know, custom steering rack and stuff.
Because depending on like, you know, the angle you want to sit in your truck versus and what's the length of the truck hood versus the Supra hood and stuff. I mean, it's possible it fit, just depends on the car.
Yeah. So, that's fucking crazy.
That thing was cool though.
Yeah, it's pretty
that
cool.
Was the
just
widest, cut the frame and weld shit
that
on.
That was the
like,
widest truck you'll ever see. It's hard to see from that picture, but it's so wide.
It would have been nicer if your caddy came back with a Supra frame underneath it. That would have been fucking awesome. That's very cool though.
The internet comments are just going to be like, that truck's just a Z4, man. It's just a BMW.
Oh man. P. Cody, performance car of the year this past week.
Are we allowed to talk about?
Yes. Well, we can't talk about, because I didn't talk to you about this, because Zach was there.
Yeah.
I can't talk about how the C8 drives. Okay, I could talk about things unrelated to how it drives. Huh. So get in the super chat if you have questions about Corvette, but I won't answer the ones that talk about how it drives. We can talk about any other thing from P. Cody except who won.
Well, I don't even know
who
won.
Do you even know who won?
No.
Okay, well, I won't tell you.
Cool.
I'll tell you after the show.
Cool.
Plausible deniability.
But yeah, so performance car of the year is 12 cars. And let me see if I can fucking remember them. Here we go. The Corvette, obviously, was one. Huracan Evo. McLaren 600LT. Lotus Evora GT. The new 911 Carrera S. The Hyundai Veloster N. The Supra. New Supra, the M2 competition, the Zach can help me out with Road and Tracks Instagram. Get down there.
Are we talking about the top six? Or are we talking?
No, I'm talking about,
the
12 that we brought to the racetrack.
What is there? Huracan?
Supra Nismo GTR. Yeah. The P Cody 2020. What else? What other cars are there? Keep going. Nismo GTR 911.
Nothing from
Corvette.
Mercedes?
Oh, the Miata RF. Okay.
Miata RF Club.
And that one was a little, that one kind of sucked because we really asked for
the Lexus
RCF Track Edition was there. We asked for a Miata Club soft top and we got the RF. And there is a little bit of a difference. Okay. Supra, is that all of them? Did I miss anything else? Is that just going to cycle through?
I'm just letting it cycle through while they're watching.
Huracan Evo. So we did a day at Thunder Hill. Thunder Hill West, the smaller of the two tracks, where we lapped the shit out of all these cars. Some of the manufacturers sent extra tires. All of them sent at least one extra set of tires. The Corvette team brought a giant hauler full of wheels and tires.
Because it was a prototype car.
The Corvette was a prototype, yeah. So, yes and no. The Corvette was built on the assembly line. It was VIN number 19. It was not a hand-built car.
I think they still call it pre-production.
That's what I meant to say.
No, yes. And it was not in a final state of tune.
Yeah.
And so the dual-clutch gearbox tune wasn't final. The engine, the ECU tune was not final. And the mag ride tune wasn't final. And they were extremely... we were happy to have the car there.
Yeah.
And the GM team that was there, like, it was, they wouldn't let it out of their sight. Literally, like all like we could do anything we wanted with the rest of the cars, and like we could drive the Corvette all we wanted too, but like at night, like they took it with them, like, and they had to keep eyes on it all the time, which I found very interesting.
It happens.
So we're because I got into this because we were talking about Supra, the new Supra, and when you have a BMW M2 and a Toyota Supra, and you get out of one and get into the other one, you go, oh my God, this is such a BMW. The Supra is like, it's just like, it's a BMW. Fully. Like, Camisa and Sam Smith, without removing really anything, found 28 BMW badges in the Supra.
Like on parts and stuff like
including
that.
Including the Toyota badge on the nose has a BMW part number.
Well, with the recall going on right now, BMW just recalled this Toyota Supra, which is kind of funny.
That's hysterical. I didn't know that. That's very funny.
Yeah, there was 7 or 8 cars that got left with potential seatbelt issues, but Toyota that issued the recall. It was BMW that issued the recall.
Oh, that's so interesting.
For the Toyota
Supra. No, the car is such a BMW, and it's on my second time driving it, I liked it. I thought it was pretty decent the first time around at the launch, but I was also totally sold a bill of goods about the history and development of the car.
Yeah.
And I believed what Toyota said, and they were fucking lying. Straight up, they were lying. It's a BMW. And so, revisited in that context, it's a really cramped BMW, and it's very clinical in its operation.
Yeah. Is it cramped to compare to the Z4 compared to the M2?
Compared to the M2. Okay. Compared to the M2, it offers a very similar driving experience, but the M2 is available in a manual. The M2 has a back seat. The M2 has a bigger trunk. I think the M2 looks better, and the M2 has a much more roomy, airy cabin.
Feeling.
Yeah. And did I say it's available to manual? It's available to manual, which is a big deal because BMW makes a good manual. It's not like it's a shit manual.
They're one of the few that make it at all.
And so the one thing the Supra has is a crazy loose front rear end. Loose. Little tires, slidey. And so, and the M2 has much more grip.
What are the tire sizes between the two?
I don't remember.
Because the M2 is so firm, like it can slide a lot. I mean, we filmed some proving grounds with it, and it did some big drifts, of course. But I wonder if it has wider, stickier tires than Supra.
I think it might also, but it's easy to... If you want to slide the M2, you can... If you want to stick the rear, you also can. Whereas if you disable everything on the Supra, it becomes very tail happy, and it makes you work a lot if you're really trying to go fast.
Okay, interesting.
The Supra, like, really, I really heavily chilled on the Supra. Like, my opinion of it was lowered substantially after doing this test. Like, I had much more fun. The Miata with the new engine...
Yeah.
Rules. That new engine's spectacular.
Yeah.
Especially on a racetrack where you're keeping it up at the top of the power band. It's like, oh, this thing wants to rev now.
It's got way more meat to it.
Yeah.
Way more torque
and
everywhere.
Way more fun to rev it out. Yeah. It's fucking great.
It does.
And the Veloster N is a riot. Like, that's like, if you are upset that Ford doesn't sell you a Fiesta ST anymore, like, look at a Veloster N.
It sounds weird, but when we had that press car, we went out in the canyons, and I was thoroughly surprised.
Yeah.
Thoroughly surprised. Matt was tossing the thing around, and I'm like,
dude, Camisa is a very good driver, and he is the most, him and Chris Harris, and maybe some of Sam, but really it's Camisa and Chris Harris, the two most like sensitive people I know to like what's going on with a car.
Yeah.
Camisa will go drive something and come back and fucking...
Yeah,
good time in the car 10 minutes ago, and Camisa will come back and be like, this fucking thing, and go on a list of like 10 things that are a complete disaster.
Yeah.
And by the end of it, I'll be like, shit, he's right. Right. And then he goes out and he runs really good times. He's very fast. And so it's hard to argue with someone who's very fast. You know,
yeah.
If you're faster than me, you know something I don't know. Yeah. And so I have to listen to you. I mean, I love Jason. Working with him is really interesting because he can make you like something that you don't think you're going to like, and he can make you hate something that you liked 10 minutes ago.
And you absolutely will learn all the things by the time you walk away from
and
him.
And I also am like...
Yeah. I've walked away from him and be like, my brain's full. Can we just take a break? Like,
remember the never-ending conversation with him and Sam Smith about whatever the fuck
it was? Yeah, I was in the parking lot.
And it's just like, if you don't physically remove them, they will just ramble at each other for like 4 hours.
Well, they were discussing...
Wonder Twins activate.
They were discussing the differences between like 9911, 9912, and 992, steering feel, tail... like behavior, understeer, all these different things. And Kamisa was just telling such detailed stories about like what he remembers about each little one and what circumstance. God. And at a certain point, Sam was like, I don't have the dictionary. Like, he's like, I'm a nerd and I've raised some stuff, but you're on another level and with the memory and the nuance
of
everything.
And also, at one point, we're talking about the Evora GT, right? We all love the Evora GT. The Evora GT rules.
Yeah.
It's not fundamentally that much different from the 400 or 410, but it's great nonetheless. But Jason at some point was like, I wonder what I thought about the Evora in 2010 when I drove it. And he pulled up a spreadsheet and read his fucking notes about it that he made. And it was like, all right, all right. And, but nothing gets by him. And so being able to work with him and see, because he's done so many of these big group test things, and I really haven't. And so seeing how he evaluates stuff and what the thought process is, and he goes, okay, now I'm going to go into this mode where I tear everything to shreds. But the point of that whole fucking spiel was that I think Travis was in the McLaren LT. And this is when we were on the road. Yeah. And we're up on a... Fucking the route they picked was extraordinary. These beautiful, beautiful roads. And Travis is up front in the McLaren LT, and Kamisa is so far up his ass in the Veloster. And we got there, and listen, Travis is fucking fast.
Yeah.
Travis, Sam, and Jason are all the same speed on a racetrack, and they're all about a second quicker than me.
Which
and
is
then
impressive.
I'm a second or two quicker than everybody else.
Yeah.
So I'm like in the middle of
which
guys.
Is a solid place to be with that. With
I'm,
that.
Fine. Yeah. I'm fine. Yeah. I practice. I do my best. I'm fine. These guys are a little quicker. Okay. But after the drive, it was like Travis was driving that McLaren not as fast as the McLaren will go, but as fast as a human being can process a back road.
Right, that he's never really been
that he's
on.
Never been on before, right? You know, you can bonsai your favorite road, but strange road, fast car, okay, stay on your side, you know, driving like a civilian,
sure,
but you're limited by the your processing power of that the human,
yeah.
You can go just as fast up that road in a Veloster as you can in a McLaren. I mean, you really can.
Yeah.
Travis did not lose Jason for a second, and the rest of us were right there behind, too. I mean, any one of these cars that we've got, up to and including the Miata. I mean, me and Jason had a fucking run where I was in the 911, and he was in the Miata. And he at the end of it, he was like, yeah, Farrah was just going Miata pace, haha. And I was like, to myself, like, well, actually, I was mobbing. And you're a lunatic, sir.
After that, you switched, I think, to the Evora, and Bowman got in the Miata. We did, like, it was a really nice uphill, twisty section before we went back down.
Yeah.
And Bowman, I was really surprised, because I was in the 911 behind you guys, and he was sticking with the Evora because it wasn't, like, a really fast, high-horsepower road.
Yeah.
And it really speaks to the Miata's ability and how narrow it is. You know, you can make apexes within the lane, which you can't really do in most of the other cars there.
Yeah, a really wide car, you can't do that. GTR, you're not, you drive.
You're not doing it in the GTR.
Yeah.
And remember when we used to film fucking tuned? Nothing would get away from the Fiesta. Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
500 horsepower car. Fiesta's right up its ass. Yeah. There's nothing that would get away from it. And so I think it was the same thing with the Veloster particularly. I mean, the Veloster in practice is substantially faster than the Miata.
Yeah.
Especially in a canyon section where you're transitioning from slow to fast and it's not where you don't have the momentum you have on a racetrack. On the racetrack, Thunderhill West, fuck me, was that Miata great. It was perfectly geared for that track to be in, like, mostly third and fourth gear, and just flow through these things, and you just go flat through everything and fucking swing the wheel around, and it was loose. It was great.
That's exactly what that car was intended for.
Go back
for.
To the picture. So what else do we have? What else? What did you? What were some of your thoughts on what you drove, Zach? Because Zach came and drove with us too.
The Evora is. I didn't drive anything on the track. I should clarify that because I heard when the Evora was shifting on the track, like the transmission moved around a little bit and it got hard to find the gates.
So this but is a, this is a Camisa.
Okay, I heard it from Sam also. Okay.
Sam is the only other one who has the feel. Me and Travis
had no issues.
Nah, me and Travis basically see eye to eye on almost every car. Jason and Sam see more eye to eye on cars, and. Jason and Sam were super complainy about the gearbox. I give Lotus a little more credit than that. It's not objectively compared to other gearboxes, including the Miata and the Veloster. It's not as precise. It's not as consistent.
I thought it was on the street. I found it to be plenty precise. Compared, yeah. Like I thought Veloster was good. Miata, they both felt similar, but they both have a feeling of like a light. They have a lightweight feel to them. Mm-hmm. You know, you have enough tactile sensations to know where you are and where the gates are, and it feels accurate.
Yeah.
But the Lotus felt like metal walls around the shifter. Yeah. Clunk 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 clunk. The shift ball they had, the metal shift, like all of that felt. At 7/8 tenths, felt great.
Yeah.
Felt real good.
When you start shifting real fast, it can get a little meh if you want. I even found when I was running laps on those track days, I would shift pretty gingerly.
Okay.
Slamming? Not really, no. It's not in the car's nature.
I tested on a section road that didn't call for that. Also, the gearing in that car is way too tall.
It's really long.
Way too tall. Yeah. So I was in second, and I could have not shifted if I didn't really want to.
Yeah.
So I shifted to 2 to 3, kind
between
of for
the
fun.
Rev range and the gearing, yeah, that car's
that road,
really tall gearing,
Donner,
man. Like, this doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Yeah, Donner Pass Road that we went up, like, that whole road was second gear for me in that car.
Yeah.
Second gear in that car, I think, goes to 73 or 74.
It's like
74.
Lambo gearing.
It's, you know what it's like? It's Cayman GT4.
Yeah,
it's like Cayman GT4, except it has the car has more torque, so you notice it less because you get that supercharger shove. But it's basically that super super long gear. If you put a different final drive in that was like, I don't know what it has, but if it has a 327 in it and you went to a 355, it would make all the difference in the world.
So good.
There's got to be a reason they geared it so high like that.
Top speed probably, and I think
MPG.
They wanted a maybe,
yeah,
and I
maybe
think
MPG.
Oh maybe yeah. I think they might. Can you do 0-60 in first gear in that car? That might also be why.
I don't think so. But it's still just a 1-2 shift. So it's still 2 shifts instead of, you know, possibly 3.
Pretty much everyone agreed that the Lotus could do with shorter gearing. But otherwise, everyone else, we were all like, So, you know, technology by lack of technology is pretty fucking cool.
It scored real high in a lot for me, like in a lot of categories. Like comfort, great. Seats are amazing. I was impressed with the door cards just in how they look and the quality for such a small company.
Yeah.
And that's a weird thing to notice. But a lot of times you get in a small manufacturer car that might be a great driver and you go, okay, I see where they save money. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, the thing to the side you don't look at or touch much. Oh, sure, it's plastic. It was nice. Pleated suede, mm-hmm. had a good design to it. It was at the right height for your arm.
They didn't pull parts from anybody else either, so it's not like you're looking
other
at it
than
and going
like blinker stalks are out of a Focus.
Certain day,
that's fine.
Yeah. You know where I saw evidence of cost cutting in the Corvette. In the Corvette, I will not say anything about how it drives, but I will say that opening the door, touching some things, sitting in it.
It's still very much Chevrolet.
You learn that 1 + 1 = 2 and 1 + 1 = 3. And if you sell a car for a certain price, you're getting a car that costs that. You're not getting some magical fucking beanstalk over here where you write a check for this much and the car you actually are delivered is worth this much.
But I think that's a very important thing for people to acknowledge because the Corvette has always been a car that can compete with things that cost $100,000 to $300,000.
As far as the numbers.
Lap time, 0-6, performance-based, whatever, quantifying the performance. And then they go, how come it doesn't look very good inside? You're like, because they have $300,000 worth of car engineering in it, but they're going to have to skip somewhere because your car costs $60,000.
Yeah. So I will say that it was comfortable. I could drive it with a helmet on. which is and not be touching the
which is hard for you.
Which listen, yeah. I was impressed that a huge variety of different drivers of different sizes were comfortable in the Corvette.
Even the smaller guys?
Yeah. You can have a smaller driver in there for sure.
Which is also a hard thing in a Corvette. Mm-hmm. I mean, just like, you know, for a lot of times for you getting in some of these other cars, you know, I remember over the years, you know, you're driving
especially
your
helmet with
the downside,
helmet.
Stuff like that. But it's also with some of the bigger supercars, like guys like Zach's size or smaller, like they can't see over the steering wheel sometimes and the seats don't adjust and things like that. So, I mean, there are some of the cars that I know that some of the guys, like especially when I was over in Italy, all those
Zach's like five eleven.
I mean, like, okay, width wise too though.
No,
I mean,
there are some cars that are not meant for tiny people.
Yeah,
for
mm-hmm.
sure. Yeah. Most of the supercars I'm at the very upper end.
Yeah.
Like, but I can, like the McLaren, I can drive with a helmet, no problem.
Yeah.
Those McLaren seats, can you go back to my, pull up my Instagram, the H.R. Geiger McLaren seats, which, there they are. So these, they come in different sizes, which I learned. These are the big ones. So,
good to know.
Yeah. At the launch, they had a Euro car with the fucking small ones. And I was like, you gotta be shitting.
Which part was narrower?
The entire seat is physically narrow. Smaller.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so these they had, and getting in and out of this car was a fucking nightmare. Like
when they took the roof off, it helped a lot.
Yes. Dropping down into it helps a lot, but there's absolutely no elegant way to get in these seats at all. And it actually kind of hurts climbing over that raw, kind of hard carbon sill. Mm-hmm. I got like a bruise from it a little bit, but I have to give them credit. Once I was in it and started driving it, that is an unbelievable seat.
I am too narrow in the shoulders for the seat they had.
Yeah.
So it actually held me fine on the bottom, but on the top, I felt like I was sitting in my Crown Vic again and had like no support whatsoever. I was all over the place. So if you're buying one of these cars, or if you jump in someone's car and you think like, oh, these seats are terrible, they're just sized wrong.
Yeah.
Because it's like you said, it's a totally fixed seat, and I don't know if they can like add more padding depending on your width.
No, they measure you and they change the padding.
See, then, because they were comfortable. They were comfortable seats, but
they weren't your size.
They were not my size.
Well, so on the track, getting in the car with the roof up because it was a spider, that sucks. On the road, I could plop down into it from above, which made it much better. But even on the street, dude, I did a really long transit stage. I did a 90-minute transit stage in the McLaren, and it was at the end of the day, and nobody wanted it. Everybody was so tired of the McLaren at the end of the day.
Really?
Yeah. And we're like, they were like, take it. I was like, okay. Obviously, you guys don't know how to set up a fucking McLaren, because you put the powertrain in track and the hand and the suspension in tour, and it's the best. And so once I was in that seat, and I was like, oh my god, like. I have like no back pain, like my legs are in exactly the right position for this, like I can't move, but I don't even want to. And I actually kind of like wedged myself in, and with my shoulders up against those shoulder deals, fuck, I went up a canyon and just on my fingertips, without having any tension on the, and I was like, oh, I get this. This makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, that's why racing seats with harnesses are so good. You may not realize, people, like when you're driving, how much effort you're putting into the wheel to hold you in place. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to keep yourself dead center, but if you drive with like a race seat and harnesses that really fits, you feel the car so much more.
Yeah, because you're not hanging on.
No.
And this is what those seats did. But even then, when we just got on the highway, just for the transiting, I was just like, man, this is a very comfortable, especially with how well that car rides. I mean, considering it's an LT, fucking rides so good.
We were lucky to be on, I would say, smooth pavement that may have had undulations in it because it was like mountain roads, but at least the tarmac quality was really good.
Yeah.
And so it might not soak up really hard edges that well, but just little bumps and like, you know, undulations in the dirt underneath the road, it was fine. That car is magic to drive.
But not as magic as a 720. The only reason that car isn't the best is because I know that a 720 exists.
Well, what is a 720 better at?
It's even more magic.
More comfortable.
Because it's faster and handles as well with less aggressive tires. And it has the magic sway bars, so it has even more articulation and can be even softer. A 720's ride, to me, is only outmatched by a Phantom. It's literally Rolls-Royce Phantom, McLaren 720. That's my order of best riding cars, period. And it goes pretty sharply downhill from there.
Mm-hmm.
You know what rides fucking terrible? That BMW i8 I have outside. I'm shocked.
Really?
Yeah, for a car that's like...
Luxury sports car.
A personal luxury coupe kind of thing. It does. I wish it had like a soft mode, like it doesn't.
Is it the suspension or is it the tire? Wheel tire?
Well, it's everything. It's hard edges.
Narrow tires. Low profile tires.
Eco-ass tires. Yeah, I haven't looked into it too much.
So they're hard too.
Hard edges. Yeah,
it's hard. That's a bummer.
Anyway, if you have...
What was the most disappointing car over... Like what car did you go into the test going, can't wait to get my hands on it, and then...
The biggest disappointment for me,
I mean, you've
was probably I drove almost all of them except yeah. I mean, I was the most excited for the Corvette,
obviously,
and I well,
I guess you can't really
I can't really say how I felt about the Corvette.
Next podcast.
But I wasn't going to go to your question with that. I don't think I was disappointed with the Corvette. I think that. Well, I don't want to get in trouble, but that's not what I was talking about. Yeah. What I was talking about was the Lexus RCF Track Edition, which is a car I cannot possibly fathom why it even exists. Because you take the... I mean, honestly, you take the RCF, which is like, all right, whatever, right? This is still alive? Okay. And then...
What makes it Track Edition?
Well, it's got carbon ceramic brakes. It's got a retuned suspension. It's got a carbon fiber hood, and it's got different wheels and different tires and a carbon fiber like body kit. There it is. Now, here's the thing. It's $96,000.
So it's been Gran Turismo'd.
Did you hear me? It's $96,000. The regular RCF is $68,000. This is a almost 30K premium.
Would you say it's 25% of the car the LFA is?
No. I would say that for your same Lexus dollar, literally the same Lexus dollar, you get an LC500. It's a beautiful grand touring car that is as well made as anything in the face of the earth.
And here's a good article apropos of this. The Lexus RCF normal one is $65,000.
Yeah.
The Track is $96,000.
Yeah. And how much how much is the LC500 right below it?
92.
Yeah. 4K less. Get the fuck out of here.
But what are you paying $31,000 for?
Carbon.
Matte paint, which is really expensive.
Yeah.
Carbon ceramics, which are really expensive. And small volume carbon fiber parts, which are very expensive. But like...
How much lighter is it than the regular RCF?
Fucking who cares? Who cares?
Not enough.
It's not enough. I mean, maybe it's 100 pounds. I don't know. It understeers like... Ugh. It was not fun to drive. Now, it's the most disappointing thing about this car. I don't know if this car finished dead last in our competition, but it was at the bottom. Nobody really liked it. Nobody really found really redeeming qualities to it. I forgot what I was going to say. Sorry. The most disappointing thing is how great the engine and transmission are, because they're really nice. The engine is so great. It's like... You know what would be my fucking jam is if you put this little Lexus V8 right here in the back of that Corvette. That's my shit right there.
Why? Just because of the sound?
Or maybe the front of the Supra.
The front of the Supra. Oh my God, would that be great?
Supra Track Edition.
Because of the revs.
Yeah.
It's not a driving impression to say that the Corvette, I believe, is the lowest revving mid-engine car on production.
Probably.
Since the Fiero.
Since the Fiero.
Well, when your competition is Lotus, Ferrari, Lamborghini, etc.
It redlines at 6,700, which is very low. I put up this Just the Noise video, and everyone's trying to analyze where my shift points, because I don't show the gauge. And the fact of the matter is, did Jalopnik share the video?
Yeah.
How nice of them. The fact of the matter is, it's an 8-speed, so it's close ratio transmission.
Small block Chevy.
And it's still a small block Chevy.
Yeah.
It's 6,700 RPM is the red line. So, yes, in that video, you are seeing my first three laps. Like, literally, someone was like, your turn, and I got in the car, set up the cameras, and you're seeing the first time I drive it even 20 feet.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I went out on the track. This is the first time I'd ever driven the track. Also, I got a van sighting lap from Ross Bentley. Which was great. I love Ross. It was awesome. He was a great instructor. I knew where I was going, but you know, so did I ring out the car as hard as it's a $1 million prototype? No. But on every straightaway in this video, this is the Just the Noise video, every straightaway and everywhere where I'm shifting at full throttle, there's a couple places where I grab a gear, like I lift to turn and grab a gear or something like that. But like on the two straightaways on the track, that's full throttle red line.
The red line's pretty low.
It's a low red line.
Yeah.
It's a low red line.
Even in the company of the rest of the cars or the five other cars at the end of the test, it's a pretty low red line.
It's a low red line. And I mean, it's very, I think that's a very interesting thing that I maybe should have expected from a Corvette. I knew what the engine was, but something I didn't really think about because I think about mid-engine cars in a different way.
Well, they're now merging these things. Mid-engine car you think of as being exotic materials, exotic manufacturer. Yeah, it's going to be different from everything else.
Yeah. What I love about it, about this Corvette, is that like Corvettes in the past, it democratizes this type of performance. You know, granted the Boxster and Cayman sort of did too, but this allegedly performs at a higher level than that. It's certainly got a lot more horsepower. It's a V8, and this is the entry level. I mean, this is the base model. I mean, there's going to be that engine bay in the back has an awful lot of room in it.
A great test in the future will be Corvette GS versus GT4.
Yeah. Yeah.
That'd be very cool.
Yeah. I mean, if they do a Grand Sport version, if they do a Z06 or a ZR1 or whatever, I mean, I don't want to shred too far, but I think that the general consensus among us was that the future versions of this is that this is the platform. Here's where we're starting.
Mm-hmm.
And then
it's a good start.
I think it is a good start.
Yeah.
I think it's a good start. I think that in some ways it's just such a huge, huge jump forward. And in other ways, it's such a Corvette. Like if people are expecting it to not be a Corvette, like it's a Corvette for sure.
So why no Mercedes?
I don't know. Why?
Test?
Yeah.
Were there any new Mercedes for this year?
AMG, GTR
Pro. If you've got the Lexus on there, why couldn't you do...
Dude, I don't know. I didn't set up the fucking cars.
No, I'm just...
not sure. I don't think there's a particular reason. When these kinds of group tests happen, there's like availability of cars and it does... I don't know why. I don't know what the logistics are of this. I think...
Didn't make the cut.
I don't know. Do they have? Does Mercedes have a new performance car? Maybe AMG GTR Pro, but
That was available in 2019 because we had one for proving grounds. So sometimes the magazine tests have a rule of like if it's not new or if it's not a 2020.
I think technically the Supra and the Miata were available for 2019. Technically they were.
Also could just be availability.
Yeah, but Travis loves fucking Miatas and the Supra was important. And so, you know.
Back when you tried it last year, production.
Yeah, I don't think the rules are quite as formal.
Yeah,
as you know, we made the test. We tried to. There's lap times, which were done by VBox, and they're backed up by all the video and the telemetry. And then we all did our scoring and our writing and our rating. But like you know, a lot of it is subjective. I genuinely don't think the lap times weigh into the scoring at all.
Well, I was going to say, honestly, like when I, all over the years, all the times I've seen this version of this test done with whatever magazine does it or whatever, you know, whatever media is going to do it, it's the subjective versions of what everybody's testing that I really like. That's what you really want to do because...
Well, that's also why we don't have a pro driver doing it. That's why Travis is doing the driving. We could have hired...
anybody,
any number. Yeah. I mean, J.R. Hildebrand is on the roster, but they didn't. He specifically did not want pro driver lap times.
Yeah,
but when we were doing the voting, like lap time didn't weigh in at all.
Yeah,
I think it was just like Travis wants a track day.
Well, if lap time mattered, like the Miata wouldn't be there. You know, it just wouldn't. Yeah, it just wouldn't be there on a track that's that big. But it's about how the car performs, even if that performance is at a lower speed than another one. Like you can have a car that is 5 seconds faster than a Miata, let's say, but it might get there in a way that feels unsafe. I'm not saying any of these cars, but like understeers like crazy, but it makes it up on the straightaway.
You're talking about the RCF track edition, basically.
I didn't drive it. You know, like if you had a Charger 392, which is a pretty good sedan, like that's a really fun kind of cheap AMG car. It might run a faster lap time than a Miata, but, or actually I'll take a better example, would be the Challenger, because it's so freaking nose heavy. Yeah. I hate the way that car drives.
The Charger's actually pretty fun.
Charger's really fun. I didn't want to make fun of it.
Good front rear
balance. It's like 5248.
Yeah, it's good.
But you know, a Challenger may get there quicker, but it's, the way it gets there is a mess, or it could be ergonomically terrible, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Let's see. What else? Oh, the 911. You know, I did this Carrera 4S in Europe, and the we've got video coming out of that Monday the 7th. This is the regular Carrera S. The good news is, for those who need all-wheel drive in their life, snow or whatnot, 99% of the time, you cannot tell the all-wheel drive car is all-wheel drive. Like, I drove it all over on the street, and the difference between driving the regular S and the 4S on the street is zero. Can't tell.
That's cool.
Except the 4S launches a little harder. The 4S launches hard.
That makes sense.
It's a beast. The 4S launches as hard as last year's turbo. It's fucking crazy. It's eye-melting. They've reprogrammed the clutches. Did you launch the 911?
Mm-mm.
So they reprogrammed the clutches now. Do you remember how last year would really ride out that first gear? Mm-mm. No more. It dumps them now, especially in the all-wheel drive cars. Fucking jumps out of its own tires.
Jeez.
Sick.
Amazing.
And so,
damn Germans.
You know, they're really good at their job.
They're really good.
Like, it's weird for me. Like, I feel very careful with this because Tangent Vector shoots a lot of Porsche stuff, which is why I don't review brand new Porsches. But
sure, that's why.
There's like a little conflict of interest. Like, I told Zach to throw out my notes on the C8 because we're shooting a doc for GM, like, about this.
Oh.
So I have to be fair about it. So all my notes about the 911 were just like, without going into the expletives, it's really annoying how good they are at their job.
Yeah.
They've
been doing it for a very long time.
Good.
Yeah. And you figure out why they're so good at it very quick. Like, I went to the factory to pick up that 4S. Like, oh, your factory looks like you really give a shit about this stuff. It doesn't look like our factories look here.
Oh, like McLaren's factory.
Yeah.
There's a focus in every part of it. And they're McLaren's very young, so they can make the factory look how they want it to look. But Porsche's been there for a long time.
Yeah, but it's not about the factory necessarily looking modern. It's about
how the white coats.
Clean
no,
and organized, and they're not wearing lab coats. They're wearing the uniforms that the pit crews wear at Le Mans. And they are, you know, and then you drive the car, and it's like, not only is the car the most comfortable car in the group, it's the best made car in the group, you know, from a quality perspective. It's very, very fast. The steering is amazing. It feels like you can't break it because you pretty much can't. And then you go on the race, and this is a regular S, and you go on the racetrack and you go, well, fuck me. This is crazy how fast this car will go. And you can slide it, and it's fine with that, and it has good steer. I mean, it's like, shit, this is so nice. It was so nice.
You go back to, you've had one job. And you did it right.
You did it real well.
I mean, there's not a lot to complain about with the 911. My only complaint of the 911, and this goes for the S and the 4S, is I don't like eighth gear. They took PDK and they added eighth gear for fuel economy. But if you're driving the car in just normal bullshit mode, it goes into eighth at, like, I don't know, 50. And it puts the engine, when it does that, at max shittiness. Like, it's at max,
pre-turbo,
like,
yeah,
drone, plus being in vacuum, plus just sucking right. Like, those flat sixes, they need to be over 2.
Yeah.
You don't have to be up at 5, but over 2. They smooth out, they quiet out, they chill out at 2 and over. Eighth gear puts this bitch at, like, 1,400 as much
it's
as possible.
Gas mileage.
Of course it is. Yeah. It just means you can't drive the car in normal auto mode. You can only drive it in sport normal because it keeps it out of that shitty drone. And even they were kind of like, yeah, you know, fuel economy. You know, like, they didn't want to do that shit.
Yeah. They just do it. They get the number and then you drive it however you want.
And like, then when you put in sport or manual, it's the same as it was before. You know, it's fucking PDK. It's great.
How did you feel about that car versus the McLaren? And I know there's a huge price difference.
The McLaren's twice the price, and it's twice the focus. You know what I mean? The McLaren, on a canyon road, the McLaren is incredible. I mean,
it shrinks a lot.
Insanely fast, and it has power delivery that is so explosive, and it just feels like it weighs nothing, because it does. The top goes down like... in 11 seconds, I think the top goes down. And I mean, it's just it just reeks of perfection and motorsport. The 911 is very lovely, but it's the best daily driver you can buy, whereas the McLaren, especially because of those seats, is like daily driving is out the window for
this. True.
Yeah. And the 911, it's just like, it can do anything. You could drive across the country. You could commute to work. You could do a track day. You can go to the canyons. Like, you can go skiing. You could do anything with that car. There's nothing that that thing will not do at a very high level.
Yeah.
The McLaren, there's some things you can't do.
Yeah, that's very true. The seats in the 911 are amazing. They're like a really nice middle ground between thin, feeling light, feeling supportive enough, not too soft, but comfortable as well.
Yeah, and
really
they don't have this crazy side bolstering, but when you go on the corners, it still holds you. It's nice. It's very nice. It's just the most well-rounded car that anybody makes. It can just do anything, and it feels like real. Like, the interior on that new 911 is super, super exquisite. And that's that, like, just the attention to detail. Not in, like, it's not filled with diamonds like Bentley. It's not that the fucking wood is from the root of a Turkish walnut somewhere, and it's, oh my god, the wood is. It's not that. It's just like,
it doesn't need an essay to justify.
No, it's plastic, aluminum, and leather. It's the same. It's just put together in such a nice way, and the detail work of the edges and the under spaces and the negative spaces and all the thoughtfulness of it. It's not like, can you give me an interior of the 911? Like, it's just so, especially compared to the Corvette. The Corvette is like, it's like, highway to the danger zone. Like, the Corvette is like, we're in Top Gun now. And whereas this, the 911, is much more like, no, it's a normal car. It's got to be, you know, practical and usable and spacious and, like, and all that. And the Corvette's like, let's get in this fighter plane cockpit. You know what I mean? And they're really cockpitting it up. Whereas the 911 is like, well, we put this here so that both people can access this screen. And, like, we put a cup, like, we made it more friendly. Although, you know, the center console there is getting progressively wider and wider as the generations go on. They had to put a cup holder there and everything.
Why do you think they're widening it?
They widened the console, I think, to get the cup holder to work there. Is that the nine? Do you have the 991 interior to compare it to? I don't know, whatever. But also because all the cars are wider now too. Because they don't have the narrow body car anymore. They've only got I know the cockpit doesn't change size, but everything is widening. Yeah, see the 997. You see how much narrower it is there?
All right, so this is a 991.
I'm sorry, 991, yes. That's 991, and then go to 992. See how much wider it is? Substantially wider.
Yeah, there's a lot more real estate on either side of the shifter.
Yeah, and the shifter's that little thingy. They made the shifter smaller but made everything else bigger. But it's okay. It's not cramped. It's a lovely place to spend your time. I did 1,500 miles across Europe and then flew to America in with the car and drove more in the car. And the one take is on Tale of the Dragon, which I recorded very early in the morning. So it's a little dimly lit, but it's a fucking cool one.
The new car has the haptic glass on either side of the shifter. Is that to Is that what I'm seeing? Took up some real estate?
It does have some. It's got some haptic glass. Yeah.
I mean, basically, it has buttons to the left and the flanking the shifter, whereas the 991 did not.
Correct.
Right.
They moved those buttons further up to make a cup holder and make the armrest space bigger.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I liked it a lot. More importantly than the actual design, though, is really just fucking how nice it was screwed together. It was really screwed together well. I'm a fan.
What else was out there?
I think that's pretty much it. The M2, I chilled out on a little bit as well. It's the M2 competition, so it has a different engine from the regular M2 I drove. I think I liked the regular one better.
Hmm.
It's been a long time, but I was a lot happier driving the regular one than I was after I got out of this one.
I heard that a lot from people after. I mean, you know, they don't sell the quote regular one in America anymore. So
right.
It's like everything you get is
competition.
Hardcore, is
yeah.
competition, and doesn't have as much like lean. It was just too stiff.
Yeah, I really liked the M2 when we had it originally at Grid Life and we were having fun with it. But I liked it better than the Supra, but compared to, I mean, and I know it's, compared to the mid-engine cars, I didn't like it as much. And we only drove it on the track. It didn't make it to the street. And a few people said, yeah, if it made it to the street, it would have been better. But the rules of the game were 12 cars on the track. And at the end of the two track days, we would vote our favorite six. And those would make it to the street. And, neither the M2 nor the Supra made it to the street. They both were kicked off the island.
What was we had an interesting talk about at dinner, body roll.
Mm.
You know, I was complaining that the Miata has too much body roll,
and I
thought how to fix it with sway bars, and Sam smartly corrected me that like that would cause all these other problems. It's actually a suspension problem. But what we were talking about is that the Camaro, which is an amazing chassis,
mm-hmm.
like it's a really good car to drive. Rolls more than you think, but when you're driving it, you don't really feel it. It feels like it's super flat and because it's so glued to the road.
Wider?
I think it's width, but it's with Sam and Jace were saying it's actually the speed at which it rolls over onto the bump stop is more measured.
Uh-huh.
Whereas you know the Miata when you go into turn just like flops over, and then once it sets, now you're cornering.
So what do you cure that with? Shocks?
Yeah, it's like shocks, coils, and bump stop. It's like everything.
Right.
But the reason I bring it up is because it's possible that what you used to like about the old M2 is that it rolled a little more, and the new one, like the M4, is just rigid.
Yeah.
It's too stiff.
It was stiff. I mean, I was driving on a very smooth racetrack, so stiffness wasn't necessarily the problem.
It's not a problem on
it.
A racetrack, but it takes away some feel of things, if things don't move at all.
I think I found A, it to be a little clinical in its power delivery. B, I found the steering was not as good as some of the other cars I had driven. Specifically, Miata, Evora, McLaren, some others I might not mention. And I was really hoping that I'd be able to slide the shit out of it. And it didn't really want to do much sliding. I got a lot of that vibratiness when you start to push, you get that vibration through the wheel, and I would try and slide it. I got a lot of vibration, and it's, I don't know. I just came back and I was just kind of like, meh, all right, that's a thing.
Do you feel like size has any?
I love the size of it.
Yeah.
I love the size of it.
Yeah.
As a street car.
Yeah.
Like I love the size of it as a street car. I don't know. I mean, maybe it's because of the company. We had a bunch of exciting cars out, and maybe if I just showed up and that was all I was driving for a whole day, I'd probably have a pretty good time. But like, I got out of that and got into another car, and I enjoyed it more.
Do you think that overall size has a factor in this specific competition? Like, I mean, all the different cars you drove, there's the Miatas, obviously, the M2, those are kind of on the smaller side.
Mm.
The Supra is not as small as what I thought it was going to be when you compare
it to... It's pretty small.
Is it?
It's about the same size as an 86.
Okay. So, I mean, do you think a smaller car could be competitive against something the size of a Corvette?
Well, it's not... I think you're asking the wrong question, because if you actually look at the cars that made it off the track and onto the road... 1, 2, 3, 4... 4 of 6... were mid or rear engine.
Okay.
And only one mid-engine car did not make it one of the mid-engine cars didn't make it to the road. Whereas one, two, three, four of the front engine cars got kicked off the island. I think we are, as far, you know, this is road and track. So yeah. Road and Track is a more focused sports car enthusiast car magazine.
Yeah.
And I think that in a lot of ways, especially with the Corvette now being mid-engine, I think in a lot of ways we are just preferring the dynamics of the rear engine or mid-engine cars.
So using that very generic algorithm that you just came up with, it's obvious that, you know, that kind of gives you the example of why GM, to remain competitive, had to do what they did with the Corvette.
Yeah. Oh, I don't think they did it for the right reasons, but I think they did it for 0-60 reasons.
Yeah.
Which would be the most Detroit thing ever. I think ultimately it was the right move.
Yeah.
There were people on the Road and Track staff that do not feel that it was the right move. Not necessarily because they think the resulting car is bad,
no.
But because they think it's no longer a Corvette.
I'm actually on that team.
Yeah.
I feel like a Corvette's been the way that it is. I get why they did it, because they literally, after driving the ZR1, like, they have hit the limit of the engineering possibility of a front engine rear-wheel drive car, without a doubt, of the ZR1. So I get why they had to do that, but I just feel like there's something to be said about, over the years, this has been the Corvette, and this mm-hmm. is what we're used to, and this is how it is.
Yeah, but I think that's a bad reason to keep doing something, because it's the way we've always done it.
Right.
Is not a great reason.
But could it have been something as simple as just not call it a Corvette anymore?
Maybe. I mean, maybe. You could have called it Zora or some
they could have done that.
That was Camisa's argument. Argument was about the whole thing, about the whole car, was, I don't want this to be the Corvette. I want this to be the Zora.
Yeah.
And it doesn't.
And had they done that, I'd be.
Yeah. And if it's the Zora, if it's placed above the Corvette, I think his argument was that they would be able to do certain things that would improve it. Stuff without driving.
Like Ford did with the GT.
Well, yeah, you could either go that route. Yeah. I mean, but I think that because it was a Corvette and not a Zora, right, it had to have a trunk that would hold fucking golf clubs.
Yeah.
Well, having a trunk that holds golf clubs means the whole rear end has to be ugly, because now you can't have a center exhaust.
Yeah.
And now you can't have radiators with cool fans back there.
Yeah.
And you can't have air flowing through shit with buttresses, because you got to have a trunk.
Yeah. The problem is the Corvette is such an automotive icon as a name.
Yeah.
And it means what it's meant for so long. To change it so radically and still call it a Corvette to guys like Camisa and me, I mean, that's our... Yeah. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with the car. I'm saying that I just, strictly from a branding standpoint, the Corvette is what it is.
But from GM's perspective,
the Corvette is their halo car.
I mean, look, let's have a comparison. Here's a comparison. Toyota, huge company, tons of money.
Yeah.
Resurrected the brand equity of 10 years of Supra.
Yeah.
Of the Supra being a legend. Resurrected all that brand equity
into,
and what
BMW.
Did they do with it? They put it on a fucking BMW.
Yeah.
So if Toyota, a smart company like that, is willing to do that, how could we possibly expect GM to rise above calling that a Corvette?
No.
Never.
No.
Not in a million years would that happen.
But
that
I said, I have to look at it as the Corvette is not the Corvette. The Corvette is their halo car. That's where it slots in.
Yeah.
It doesn't slot in as their front engine rear-wheel drive sports car. It slots in as that's their halo car. And so in that respect, the Corvette's the Corvette.
Yeah.
That's got to be their top car.
Yeah.
So
right, because I think to go to the, what has it always meant to them? You know, maybe to people in the crowd, what it's meant to them is
it's
front engine rear-wheel drive sports car.
Mm-hmm.
But like you said, to GM, it's been halo sports car.
Yeah.
So if the thing that they have to do to make it competitive is to do this.
The Corvette has to be the car that's winning the races. The Corvette
right.
has to be the car that's doing certain things for them on that standpoint. Just because it happened to be front engine rear-wheel drive this whole time.
Exactly.
So that's what you have to kind of retrain your brain into doing, because...
Yeah.
Yeah, just because it was something that doesn't... It's weird to say, because it was this for so long, it doesn't mean it's that.
But I can't think of another company
that's
done anything
the platform it's on
that radical.
there was done something, what, as radical as move the engine in their car?
Yeah.
I mean...
And still called it the same thing.
They still called it the same thing.
Other
yeah,
than
I don't think.
The Eclipse.
Eclipse. Oh, Eclipse Cross. Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
So.
Oh, that's funny. Who else has ruined their brand equity?
I mean, there's not many cars that where they move the power plant and it's totally yeah. inside of the car, period, yeah. let alone call it the same name.
Yeah. That's what I was trying to think. You know, it's,
yeah,
it's
no, that's a first, it, I think.
A lot of what the new Corvette is very radical for a lot of reasons. It's radical for GM to do a mid-engine car. It's radical for them to change what their heritage is. It's a really historically significant time in being an automotive enthusiast because
yeah.
that love it or hate it, that changes the game in a lot of aspects and it's going to be felt across the board to everybody.
I think it's interesting. It might. The question is most people aren't going to get to drive one before they buy it. Not for a while,
yeah.
right? So the question is, and if they do, they're going to get a very short test drive around the block, right?
Yeah.
They're not going on racetrack with it.
No.
Not for a little bit. So the question is, will sitting in it, touching it, playing with it, smelling it, because it smells exactly like a GM vehicle. it smells, I mean, you rent an Equinox, that smell,
yeah.
that's what the Corvette smells yeah. like.
Yankee Candle if you're looking for Christmas ideas.
And so will those people be converted out of Porsches and out of high-end luxury cars?
Well,
Detroit's problem always has been that they don't know the first fucking thing about luxury.
Sure.
Not a thing. And Corvette would be the kind of people to sell this car, or GM, excuse me, would be the kind of people to sell this car and be completely oblivious to the fact that when you open the door to this car, the very first thing you see is a fucking quarter of a cent stamped piece of black plastic
yeah.
on that trim. It's not yeah. that the 911 thing that says yeah. kills bugs fast. Like it's not an inlaid. It's like this.
I mean, my three series wagon has an inlaid M, you know, yeah. M badge.
So there's
stainless steel.
There's like some obvious, forgetting about how it drives. There's some obvious cheapness.
The flip side of that we talked about is, so long term, does the mid-engine Corvette all of a sudden introduce a new crowd of people to a mid-engine car, and then all of a sudden the other mid-engine cars start showing interest where, okay, I drove a mid-engine Corvette, I really, really like it, a mid-engine Ferrari must be that much better now. And
maybe.
I would have
yeah,
never considered
no one
it
was into Ferraris before they drive a mid-engine Corvette.
No, but there are guys that are, you know, that would have never driven a mid-engine car before.
Yeah.
You know, they would have never considered, either they couldn't afford it or it's just not the experience they were looking for. They're these hardcore, all of a sudden now the Corvette's mid-engine
yeah.
makes it okay.
It democratizes it. It definitely democratizes it.
I don't think that's yeah. as big a problem as you're making it sound.
I don't think it's
really
gonna, I'm not saying that it's a problem. I'm just curious as to what the long-term effects of introducing a lower dollar point mid-engine car to the masses, what does that do to the other high-end mid-engine cars around? Does it water them down? Does it make their sales higher? Because now
what it might do is encourage other manufacturers to make their middle costing cars mid-engine instead of front.
Right.
That would be interesting.
Right. But that's my point, is that this is such a significant thing that I don't think that a lot of the enthusiasts think about it. The ripple effect of this is going to be years to see what this one change that GM made, what does that change overall? Does it, like you said, does it change maybe all of a sudden, you know, we start inexpensive mid-engine cars? Does the high-end mid-engine, you know, have a new crowd of, you know, sales? We don't know. We don't know what it's going to do, but it's I think it's,
you know, I have
a
strong
change.
Voting record of wanting to keep engines in the front of the car. We all know this. You know, I was raised in that. The Bible says it. But after driving this Corvette, I have to say I might be coming around on this thing. That's what I'm picturing. When you're like,
yeah.
some people that are that don't drive mid-engine might switch.
Why not?
Like, well, those are usually six figures. That's why.
Why not?
I don't think anyone has a problem with where the engines are. They might have a preference, but I don't think anyone I don't think anyone needed converting one way or another. I think people just like the cars that they can afford and they can drive. And, you know, now people might not like Ferraris because they didn't like Ferraris or they don't like foreign cars or something,
yeah.
but I don't think you're going to have people that are going, I was against mid-engine vehicles until I drove this
yeah.
mid-engine
vehicle. I don't think that's an angry person that really exists.
Yeah, no.
I think there are going to be some young people that would be looking at an M4 or maybe a used 911 or something in that area.
Does this all of a sudden start to remove some of the stigma of it's a Corvette?
Well,
guys like us for so many years up until recently was like, I love the Corvette. It's great to drive. I mean, you had your C5, which was rare for guys our age to be in a C5 or any Corvette of that era. Mm-hmm. We didn't want to be that guy.
Well, the C5 was like this. It was a big jump forward at the time.
Yeah.
At the time, the C5 was like, because my whole life was the C4.
Yeah.
From when I was born until I was old enough to buy my own, it was literally C4, like, well, yeah. C4. So when the C5 came out, I was like, fucking finally! So I think a lot of people now, they see the C6 and 7 sort of as the same kind of thing. And tired of that, and so I think you are definitely going to get some young people to go, wow, I can afford this, and maybe you know, rather than an NSX or a GTR or some 911s or a Cayman or this, now you're going to look at a Corvette too, because the engine is in the right place. On the other hand, the downside of brand equity is brand baggage. And brand baggage comes with brand equity. In fact, you pack brand equity into brand baggage and bring it with you. And and brand baggage is gold chains and fucking Hawaiian shirts. And based on Twitter today, all them Corvette Forum guys, they got them on order.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see what the conquest sales are. Like, who's trading in their 911 for a new Corvette? Like, I don't know.
I think I don't know how much of that'll happen, but I think the brand baggage thing, where it's like the old guys are driving with the Hawaiian shirts and stuff, I think that's kind of fading, because think of how many young people you see driving either a Camaro or Challenger or a Charger, and they don't, and there's plenty of old dudes that are wearing Corvette clothing or hand-me-down Corvette clothing doing the same thing. So I think it's just like what the car is about is people are more about how much fun it is.
Cars and Coffee, I'll see someone in their 30s driving a Z06 or something like that, or a modified Corvette. Like, I see that, but we went to Manhattan Beach Cars and Coffee a couple weeks ago, and it was like Corvette Cruisers Club, you know, and it was a bunch of old folks in
unfold their chairs,
you know, and that's fine. Do their thing, but I think when folks in their 20s see that, they don't go, "Man, I want to be a part of that club." Whereas they see Luftgekult and the period correct guys and Singer and you know that, and they go, "Ooh, you know," and I want to be a part of that club.
It's just going to be interesting to see what ripple effect this one decision makes. You know, we'll be having this chat 3 or 4 years from now, and say how, you know, I'd be curious to see what changes happen in 3 or 4 years that we can go back and be like, because the Corvette did this, maybe that's why that this happened that way.
You know what's gonna be interesting this year? SEMA.
Yeah.
Fucking the dollar cars are flowing like the salmon of Capistrano right now. Everybody, you get a dollar car, and you get a dollar car, and you get a dollar car. Everybody gets a dollar car.
Unfortunately, there's not going to be anybody at SEMA.
Well, I'm not going.
No. They're duff on this year. I talked to a lot of people.
Really?
That we can get passes.
Is it because the Saudi SEMA?
No.
Is it because they're competing with the Saudis?
No, SEMA audited their memberships this year.
Get the fuck out of here.
If you have a business and you manufacture something.
Uh-huh.
So take a shop like VF Engineering, okay, mm-hmm. who's been a member of SEMA since he could, has attended SEMA for the last 12 or 15 years, however it is. A shop like that who they manufacture the tunes and the superchargers and something that, you know, they can sell retail they spend SEMA, and the owner will go out, and maybe one of their techs will go out and meet with their vendors and their suppliers, and they have their annual meetings like Magnuson and stuff like that. So this year, SEMA would go back to a shop similar to VF and say, "Well, you manufacture something, and you don't have a booth, so you don't get passes."
Oh.
So if you can sell something or you can have a booth there to show off what it is that you're making, and you don't have a booth, you don't get passes. So the ripple effect to that is that a lot of, you know, you lose a lot of the riffraff, but the smaller shops that you know, a shop like VF can't afford to have a booth there, plus lose 3 or 4 guys for the entire week and all this other stuff. I mean, it affects them big time. So they use that show to go meet with the Magnusons and the other stuff like that. So and then the ripple effect is that Magnuson uses that show to meet with all their vendors like that.
Yeah.
And then they say, okay, instead of having to go and have a ground team and have a Northeast guy and a Southeast guy, just meet at SEMA. We'll have our annual meetings once a year and call it a day. All of these shops now, if you're a tuner shop and you don't actually sell anything retail, yeah, you can get passes as your member SEMA. But if you sell something retail that you make and you manufacture and it would qualify to display in a booth somewhere and don't have a booth, no tickets.
Was that really the source of the problem? Shops that manufacture things but don't have booths?
They did an overall audit and they just basically were like, if you know, they were just cracking down on tickets this year. Part of it is with the convention center being under construction, they want to try and manage the crowds a little bit. Next year's going to be even worse. They lose the North and South Hall at SEMA.
So they're trying to shrink it.
So they're trying to shrink it a little bit and kind of control it, but without warning. Like, does these shops, like, you know, say, look, you know, we're going to do this year, but next year just know you're not getting tickets. And maybe give them enough time to say, okay, well, I'll have a booth. But, like, you know, I use VF as an example because I was, you know, I was there with Nick trying to organize our SEMA plan 6 months ago. And, you know, he had planned on going like he did the year before. And they're like, no, you need a booth. He's like, I can't come up with, you know, a booth and displays and, you know, have to hire extra staff and all this other stuff. I got 6 months to get all this stuff ready to go. And you're telling me I now? And it's expensive. And it's going to be interesting to see SEMA, you know, who, you know, what's there. But wow, it will be inundated with Corvettes and Supers, I'm sure.
Yeah. You think the other, what's the other one? PRI? Apex. You think
Apex.
People are going to go across the street to Apex?
It's the same passes. I mean,
oh, it is?
Yeah.
Well, maybe not.
Yeah.
That sucks. All right. That's a bummer.
Yeah.
Fuck. Well, good thing I wasn't going anyway.
No.
What do we got for questions? We got a bunch? We got a bunch. I think we got a bunch. Can you zoom in so I can read it?
Who's the first jerk to ask you about the Corvette driving after you told them not to?
Well,
we'll see when we get to him.
We'll see. let's see. Oh, we got a watch question. All right, Kyle B., get in the super chat next few minutes if you're with us live. We're going to answer some questions before we end this show. And we got a bunch. We're going to try and get to all of them. Kyle says, I'm looking at my first big boy watch, $4,000 to $5,000 budget. I'm looking at the Omega Planet Ocean. And, oh, Jesus Christ. He's trying to, and he's... Okay, he's done something. Can you just show this screen, Zach? Because what he's done is he thinks he's been helpful by showing me the Omega reference numbers, but Omega reference numbers aren't like Rolex or like Patek. A Patek reference number is like 5711, 5711. The Omega, he goes, I'm just going to read this. Having trouble deciding between 232.30.46.51.01.001 and... 215.30.44.22.01.001. Bro, I don't know.
I don't know what any of that means.
Those are reference numbers. Can you just copy those entire numbers into Google and just get an image of those? The Omega Planet Ocean is a really nice watch. It's one of the nicest watch they make. And by typing in the reference number, you can get a picture of it. I think they're just basically the same thing, just different colors. I like the Planet Ocean a lot. The best ones, I think, are the black with white. Is that the one you just got? The black with white? Yeah, that's the jam right there. The Seamaster Planet Ocean black with white accents is the fucking shit, bro. I like that a lot. There it is. That was one of Carl's favorite watches, too. The black with white and also the black with blue is really good. But the black with white is my shit. I don't like the chronographs. But if you like a chronograph, it's good. I like the Diver black with white. Go with that.
Good call.
Go with that, Kyle. Thank you for giving us those reference numbers that are just obscene to look at. CH says, I live in Vancouver. I love your city. And I want to get a new manual transmission car to daily and track on occasion. I'm thinking of a Honda Civic Type R. Could afford to stretch my budget to a base Cayman, but not the S. Ooh, Civic Type R versus base Cayman.
Comes down to looks.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, you shouldn't buy a Civic Type R. Well, okay, hang on, let me back up. Civic Type R is a great daily driver. It is. It's very practical and comfortable. It goes pretty fast, but it doesn't really... there's not really a sacrifice.
Yeah.
You can daily one. A base Cayman has two seats. So if you are okay driving a coupe, you shouldn't buy a sedan. You know what I mean? Like, if you're going to go on a track and, like a Cayman, even a base one, has such better dynamics than a four-door sedan, any four-door sedan.
Yeah.
And so, if you don't need a back seat, your search should be for two-seater cars, in which case, Cayman, Corvettes, used Corvettes for sure, used Caymans. used Cayman S is a great place to be. Maybe a six-cylinder Cayman with an extended warranty rather than a base four-cylinder Cayman. I would look there. But my main piece of advice for you is that the Civic Type R is great for four-cylinder front-wheel drive cars with a back seat. If you don't need the back seat, you should eliminate it from your options. Because it's a big car. The back seat has a lot of room in it, which is great if you need it. But if you don't need it, you're lugging a lot of car around.
The only thing those two have in common is their manual transmission.
Totally true. Brian Onofre says, reviews say that the Toyota 86 limits are low, slidey, and fun on the eco tires. What tires for my V6 Mustang would mimic this feeling? I autocross and daily drive the car. Zach?
I mean, whatever's cheap and hard.
Yeah.
That's really what the FRS tires are, the Prius tires, right?
Basically.
They're hard. They're 400 tread wear, I think.
If you go to your local discount tire place and you cannot pronounce the brand name, that's going to be a fun tire.
Oh, yeah. What are my drift tires are like Bavarius Brarus or something. Yeah. Like they're 60 bucks.
Yeah.
The tires that came on my Crown Vic were terrifying because they were super hard and they last forever. I mean, anything that's a 400 tread wear.
High tread wear. 400 and up. You know, fucking get some snows in the summer.
That was our next thing is winter tires.
Yeah, high tread wear eco tires and if you want to replicate it without spending money, just pump your tires up to 40 psi
or 70.
Higher.
Or 70. Kitty Snipe says, would you rather drive an S550 Mustang sized Exige? Or an Exige-sized Mustang. Yeah, absolutely Exige-sized Mustang. A fucking tiny Mustang would be rad.
That's what the Escort was like, right? Yeah. The old one?
An Exige-sized Mustang is, a Ford Escort Mark I.
Right.
Basically, yeah. Doug Horn says, he liked the Watch and Listen episode with Carl. So I guess we haven't really talked about it together. Carl died. That's not a good way to intro that, but...
Yeah.
We lost my friend Carl a week and a bit ago, and it's been very difficult for me. I have actually cried quite a bit because Carl was a fucking legend. Food, watches, cars, people, business, crime. Carl knew about everything. And people who describe Carl, they describe him as like an explosion or like the Big Bang or like someone called him the match and the kerosene, you know, and he'd walk in and just like blow up a room, like just fucking, I'm here now, I run this. Like,
and people use those descriptions for other people all the time, but like legit, that is the absolute case.
Was Carl. And he passed away, we think, of a heart attack. He was not a model of health, but you know, he was. I go listen to the shows with him. He talked about why he lived his life the way he did, and I couldn't argue with it. No. I mean, he watched his father, you know, save for this supposedly epic retirement, travel, big house, all this shit, do all the right things, and got Alzheimer's at 61, and now he's in his, I don't know, 80s maybe, 70s or 80s, but he doesn't know his own fucking name.
Jesus.
And so Carl was like, fuck that. I'm not doing that. I'm having fun every day. I'm doing exactly what I want to do every day. And, you know, he busted his ass. He's a hustler, you know, amazing chef, worked hard. But, you know, he had a good time all the time. He maximized his use of the internet for exclusively fun things. And he's in that shirt, in that photo, he's wearing a cat shirt. He had 100 shirts with cats on them, all different. You know, he taught me a lot about watches. He really influenced my watch collecting habits. I'm wearing the Rolex Explorer right now that Carl, after explaining to me why my Rolex Batman sucked and the Rolex Explorer is a much better watch, I sold the Batman and I got Explorer, and he was 1,000% right. I don't know. We're going to be talking about Carl for a long time. I had a t-shirt made with the guys at Blipshift, and the Carl's restaurant, La Cubana, somehow in conjunction with Guy Fieri, they are starting some kind of foundation for aspiring chefs in Carl's name. It's I don't exactly know what the plan is, but I'm talking with them. We are going to sell this shirt. Pull that picture back up, Zach, of the shirt. And it's on the front. It's Carl being very Carl with a slice of pizza, admiring. And on the back, it says, it's just a fucking great picture of Carl. Yeah. I really, really like it. Pinky up, as always. And on the back, it
says, they nailed the eyes.
They nailed it. It says, "Don't trust your own taste. Chances are you have none," which is one of my favorite lines from Carl. He had a lot of great lines. "I'd rather eat crumbs with bums than steaks with snakes." I like that one.
That was a good one too.
This restaurant is beautiful.
Yo, La Cubana fucking rules, is dude. Beautiful. Hannah and I went and ate there, and it was amazing. And they are going to continue serving chef's food. It's a beautiful restaurant in the meatpacking district. Cuban food, I don't know if you guys know this, but Cuban food is fucking disgusting. It's not good. It's just they don't have good ingredients there, and it's like just not good. Carl made
good.
amazing Cuban food, and it was absolutely delicious.
We should say Cuban food in Cuba is known for being
even
pretty
Cuban food in America sucks most of the time. It's just not good. It's not that flavorful. Like most of the time, not all of it, but like in general, it's not that great. But Carl and that restaurant was popping the fuck off, dude. It was music and dancing like every night, it's like there's like so many fun moments that I won't get to enjoy with Carl anymore, which is really, really sad. But like I'm really glad there's like so much recorded media of him. I went and listened to I last week when I was on the road, I ran his episode of the Watch and Listen podcast, which I called Carl Ruins Everything, and I ran that as the Smoking Tire. And it's such an amazing piece of radio. It's just he's so good. He's just like, here's a guy whose job it is to cook food, and he is better on a microphone than 99% of professional broadcasters working today. He's fucking gold. Yeah. He's gold everywhere. Everywhere you bring him, he's gold.
Well, doing this, the microphone,
yeah.
And I was in radio for years, I found that the guys that are better than that are the guys that's just their personality. That's just who they are. Mm-hmm. And Carl's personality, whether you put a microphone in front of him, whether you put a stove in front of him, or whether you put an audience in front of him, yeah.
Because he could be his radio guy,
yeah,
while cooking a meal for like 30 people. Yeah. He wouldn't be distracted by the food. He'd continue to entertain you the whole time.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It's an amazing skill.
He
amazing
came to my
person.
House and taught me to make matzo ball soup, which I've been trying to replicate ever since. And I've never gotten it exactly the way he's gotten it. And it really bums me out that I won't be able to have him teach me how to do it perfectly. But I made it last weekend, and I'm going to keep making it until I get it right. I know how to do it, but I keep fucking up little things. And I made it almost right after I heard he died. I made it. And I was so fucking distraught that I forgot to put vegetable oil in the matzo balls. And I made the soup and the noodles and the vegetables were perfect. And I fucked the matzo balls up. But I know how to make good matzo balls like he did. He made to make matzo balls. Normally it's like matzo meal, little salt, eggs, vegetable oil. That's it. Mix it up, and then you fucking make balls. Carl separates the yolk from the whites and meringues the whites and makes the fucking matzo balls with a meringue.
Whoa.
And, like, just does all this other shit. Like, he the chicken for the broth, like, you make it from scratch. So, like, you roast the chicken in the oven for 45 minutes, but then you put it in a colander with all the scraps of the vegetables, the onion skins and shit, and then you put the colander over the boiling water, you pour more, and then you cover it, and so as it steams, the steam then drops back over the chicken and the skins as it goes back in. It's fucking amazing.
So it's like extracting more and more deliciousness
from all
the stuff.
It just recycles its flavor. It's so amazing.
Wow. Yeah.
And I'm going to get it right this fucking weekend. I'm going to get it right. Like, it's like, and when he came to my house, I was like, he made this soup and we were hanging out and drinking and he made the soup before we went out to dinner. I thought the soup was going to be the dinner. He made the soup. We ate the soup and he goes, steak? And we got in a fucking Uber and went to Adam Perry Lang in Hollywood and ate all the meat after this matzo ball soup. But he made me this soup and I was like, how is it that a fucking Cuban guy can make this soup. And he goes, cuz, listen here. I won triple G on a panel full of Jews with this soup. That's what he called Guy's Grocery Grams, triple G.
Triple G.
He goes, I won triple G on a panel full of Jews. Nothing to worry about.
That's fucking funny. He just understood it, man. You know, like a chemist.
Well, that's the only, the book that Carl told me to read, and is the most interesting book maybe I've ever read, is called What Einstein Told His Cook. And it's a book about food science and how, why does salt behave this way? Why does sugar behave this way? What do yeast do? How do they work? And it's just like, amazing. What Einstein Told His Cook is the name of the book.
Cool.
All right. Questions? We have more. We still have more. I know. I took a tangent into Carl, but we didn't.
I'm not laughing at the tangent. No. I wasn't being disrespectful. I was like, it's like, okay, we'll go back to.
Go back to that.
Yeah.
After talking about death.
Right.
Yeah, I know. Mr. Someone says, is now a good time to Fox Body? Is now a good time to buy a Fox Body? Are the prices going to keep going up, or will they come back down again?
Nope, they're going up.
Up. I mean, not up like a Fox Body. It's not going to be like $100,000. It's not going to be a Carrera RS.
It's not going to be an $82,000 yeah. Integra Type R?
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, if you found a Celine, let's call it a Celine Fox Body with 3,000 miles on it, it might be 80 grand.
Maybe.
It might be.
Maybe.
Fucking mine went for 65.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, it's a custom, but like, you know, the most expensive Fox Body to ever sell at auction was 82 grand.
Yeah.
It was a 7-Up, a brand new delivery miles 7-Up car. But it's happened.
Yeah.
I don't think they'll come back down. A Fox Body is a fixed, there are a fixed number of them.
Yes.
There will never be more than there are now. So,
I think if you found a decent condition one and improved it slightly from whatever it is that you got, you're likely not to lose money on mm-hmm. it. You can enjoy it, drive it, and likely maybe not make a ton of money on it, but not depreciate nearly what other projects in that era would probably are going to.
Mm-hmm. A couple RIPs for Carl, indeed. We will have many RIPs for Carl. There's going to be, I'm not sure what we're going to do on an official basis, but we are going to do something. And the shirt, we're going to donate all the money. Obviously, I'm not. I think there was a couple of people. You know, the podcast I did last week where I recorded an intro and then I reran the watch and listen episode, I put ads on it. And, you know, I put ads on it because we have to. We have advertisers. We have deals. But also, a couple of people in the comments got real shitty with me about, you know, your friend dies and you sell ads, you cold fuck. And I was thinking about Carl, and I could picture Carl being like, cuz, I fucking die and you don't even cash in? What did I teach you? You fucking pussy. You know what I mean?
The downloads are going to be huge.
I picture Carl going, you don't fucking sell ads on me. I fucking die and you don't fucking make a buck. You're a bitch. I can picture Carl fucking
exactly right too.
Yeah, right? That would be exactly Carl.
That was like, exactly
what do you
Carl.
Mean you're not cashing in?
What do I got to fucking do?
You're getting paid double on the same content. It's great.
Yeah. Michael Umerhofer says, what is one car I hated until Jason or Chris Harris changed my mind? Mercedes 190E Cosworth, 2.316.
You liked it more or less?
I listened to Jason's arguments for it, and I thought that maybe my impression of the car was wrong. And that maybe he knows more than I do because he drove the Euro Spec 1 and because he's had a lot of time and driven a bunch of stuff. And he cited some very specific examples that it's better than the M3 at certain things and whatever. And I don't love the E30 M3 either. And so I thought, okay.
Is the only 190 you drove stock American
yeah.
import?
Yeah.
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 It's different.
It's a very different.
We've talked about it before,
yeah.
But yeah.
So that's the one that comes to mind. Yeah. I don't think they didn't really change my mind. No, I don't think there was anything else I hated until they changed my mind. Jason talked me out of wanting to buy a 328, a Ferrari 328. which
you had been talking about doing.
Which I had been talking about doing, and he talked me out of it because he was looking at a 328 and he went to drive one, and he cited some very specific reasons why I should not buy one, which is fine. He just saved me $80,000.
Yeah. He's a great resource.
Yeah. So that's one. Jordan says, what are my thoughts on the M2 comp versus the original M2 I drove? I don't know if this...
We kind of covered it earlier.
I think
in the
we
show.
Covered it based on the time of that comment. Yeah. I don't know if it was necessarily because I drove the original M2 by itself and I drove this one back to back with a bunch of other cars I happen to like better, but I got out of the M2 comp this time feeling a little cold and detached, and it just didn't resonate with me, despite the fact that objectively I think it was pretty good. I think it had 15.7 inch brakes. I think it has like huge Dodge Challenger size brakes, and that the braking performance wasn't all of that impressive for the size of those insane-o brakes. And I remember being like, well, why do they have to be this big? Is this thing secretly like way heavier than I think it is? I wasn't bothered by their existence it being that big, but I did a video with it, which you're going to see in the edit. But I was like, this thing has the biggest fucking brakes ever, and it's like not like locking up the top. You know what I mean? Like it's so
not bringing you down as rapidly as you expected.
I was just left with it being kind of like, okay, it's all right. It wasn't really. It wasn't really.
It was a boat anchor.
It wasn't really the my thing, but that's okay. I think my personal taste over the last couple of years has really transitioned towards rear and mid-engine cars and how they drive, as opposed to how a fast front-engine car drives.
When I drove the M2, it was literally the only car I drove that day, so I had nothing to compare it to.
Yeah.
So and I also, on the road I was on, I wasn't on the brakes as hard as you were on a track, so I can't really speak to it.
Yeah, I hope that answers your question. MB is French. He wants to know about the cats. The cats are doing well. They are integrated very well. The kittens annoy Conrad a little bit, but Nikki snuggled with Pico last night in bed, and it was great. Their quirks: Pico sleeps under Vinny's bed for pretty much all day, and then comes out at night.
Conrad has been all over my bed lately too. I don't understand. Conrad, like the last couple of days, he's been bonding with me.
Well, because your bedroom is out of the way of the kittens.
Yeah,
and he's been annoyed with.
He
the
likes
kittens.
To, he jumps on the corner of my bed, and like certain times of the day, the sun will hit just right, and he likes to sit in the sunbeam on the corner of my bed.
He follows the sun around the house. Conrad, unfortunately, is a little sick and has congestive heart failure. And he's 14, so we've
he
got
is?
Him. Yeah.
Whoa.
So we've got him starting medication. Did Hannah give him medicine?
I told her.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
Prilosec OTC.
I don't know. You know, I don't
and
know.
I told her we needed a lesson on how to do that when we got home.
Totally. And so you know, he's an old man now, and so we've got medications for him, and you know, he could live years, or he could live months, and we're not entirely... There's no really no way to determine how that will go down. But it was really... I felt like... I learned, like, yesterday, I was like, wow, I learned how my pet is going to die. And...
You don't know that. He could get hit by a bus.
He could get hit by a bus. That's true.
He could fall off one of the railings.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a tough couple of days. But,
fuck.
You know, he's fine. He's
But you know what? I mean, listen, there was something weird with him, and that's why brought him in. So had you not done that, he's on some medicine that, like you said, he could be okay. But had we not done it.
Yeah. So anyway, that's what's happening. And then Nikki is very... very snuggly, and Finn doesn't know how to snuggle yet, but he really tries. But
he really wants
to snuggle, but like he doesn't like know how to do it, so he's just like all over you. It's very funny.
Nikki likes to steal humans.
Step
food.
One is not moving. That's the first step.
Yeah. Michael says, Steven says, thanks for the watch buying advice. Oh, there we go. Michael says, are we planning on making a 1 million mile Lexus or similar into a safari? Nope. Mm-mm. Nope. Nope, nope. JR says, what do I think of the NSX? I have four videos on the NSX. Street, track, 2017, 2019.
Numerous podcasts.
It's probably 40. It's probably 40 minutes of NSX content. Clay says, should I keep my 86 AE86 or sell and buy a 72 240Z?
Ooh.
If that's a new 86 you're talking about,
sell.
Sell. If it's an 80s 86, keep.
Yeah.
Tomas says, is a Lotus Exige S driving experience worth the S? Or worth the money?
Worth the money.
Yeah, because a Lotus Exige S driving experience costs nothing. Because you buy the car for $50,000, you put 5,000 miles on it, and then you sell it for $50,000. So it doesn't actually cost you anything to own a used Lotus. That's the truth. All it costs is fuel and tires. Other than that, you absolutely wash out every single time. A couple nice people with donations who don't even need us to do anything for them. Don't even jump, monkey. Just take this money. Isaiah wants to know what my take is on the recent Mazda RX-9 rotary rumors. Don't have one. Haven't heard the rumor. Wouldn't even give a shit if I had. I mean, honestly, the RX-8, the RX-8 was one of the worst sports cars I've ever driven.
It's such
terrible.
Because the engine was terrible.
Terrible.
But the rest of it, like, I thought the handling was fine. The steering,
it was okay.
That, but the engine sucked.
It was so bad.
And it ruined a chassis that is very good.
It made the power of a four-cylinder while consuming the fuel of a V8, and it had a tiny little tank that would, and I almost got stranded in that car. What a fucking piece of shit!
And it
sounded
like a little. I sound like a dentist drill. Yeah.
I don't have any. I don't miss fucking.
I appreciate. I'm trying. I think following Hurt from Hoonigan is helping me appreciate rotaries for their differentness, but they objectively suck.
Yeah,
because they're bad at their job.
Yeah,
kind of.
They're interesting, but they're bad at their job.
Yeah. Saucy P says $15,000 New England daily driver. C5 Corvette, no. 86, no. Fiesta ST,
yes.
That's the answer. Michael says, can you recommend a first watch between $800 and $1,500? Okay, interesting position to be in, Michael, because between about $500 and about $2,000, you're not really getting anything.
Yeah.
Like a nice Seiko is $500 or $600 and is every bit of the watch you're getting with like a $2,500 entry level Swiss Baumann Mercier kind of thing. $800 to $1,500 is going to be your $500 watch, but with a hashtag branding added on it. So
like
that
Weiss watch, isn't that?
Well, like a Weiss watch that's not one of Cameron's movements. So for me, Weiss makes a couple of different watches, three, in fact, different watches, and then some sub-variations of that. The American issue field watch is the only one that has Cameron's movement in it, and that's the one I have, and that's the one you have.
Yeah.
Those are $2,500. If you want the Swiss movement one, it's $1,500. So you can get a Weiss. You can also get, let's see, Sinn, S-I-N-N. Yeah. Junghans, which is spelled Junghans, J-U-N-G-H-A-N-S. Alpina is a nice one. Let's see, Seiko for sure. Orient. Junghans is a very Bauhausy kind of German minimalist thing. If it was me, I'd buy a $500 Seiko Turtle, which is a fucking amazing watch. Second part of that question. If I bring a Coyote swapped manual Crown Vic to LA from North Carolina, will you drive it for a one take? Zach will.
Fuck yes, I will.
I will not.
That sounds amazing.
It does. It sounds great for Zach. Carl says, "Hey Matt, love the show. What was a car that before driving it you hated it, but after the drive you liked it? And have you ever gone to Montreal? I have been to Montreal. It's lovely. What's a car I didn't like until I drove it and then it changed my mind? That's very interesting. I don't." Let's see, what's a lot better than I expected it to be? This is tough. What did I expect to hate? Bullet Mustang? Bullet Mustang I really liked. Expected to hate it.
You expect to hate it because you just hate the idea behind it?
Yep.
I felt that way about the three-door Veloster, and then I drove the new one, and I was like, don't care about the three-door thing anymore.
Yeah. That the Veloster N is good enough that the three doors no longer matter. BMW i3. I love the i3. I thought it drove great. In fact, compared to the i8, I think the i3 is a much better use of this technology.
Yeah, that car felt really great around like 20 to 40 mile an hour curves.
Yeah, and with the surprisingly good handling, very comfortable, incredibly well made. The only reason the i3 sucks is because BMW intentionally put a small fuel tank in it because you can't. It's a range extended EV as opposed to a hybrid. If the EV range is bigger than the fuel range. So they put a small tank in it to reduce the fuel range to below the EV range, which is fucking stupid because they had a car that was as practical as a Volt that they made substantially less practical because they would rather have EV extended credits than hybrid credits in our stupid credit system. That being said, they drive really nice. Daniel says, "You're making me hungry. Sorry, buddy.
Go to La Cubana."
Henry says, "Earlier I said that the road test route for P. Cody was fantastic. What was it? Now, I don't fucking remember. Let's see. We left
Highway 70 was part of it.
Yeah, we left Thunder Hill, and we went northeast into, what was that, National Forest? Pull up a map. Yeah. We went northeast from Thunder Hill. Was it 70? It was at 70, and then we what's the National Forest there? What's that one? Plumas. We went into the Plumas National Forest, and then we turned south and we ran down the back roads in that National Forest. That's pretty much it. Yeah, pull that over, pull that, drop that, and then we ran south to those along those lakes. And then we ended up in Truckee.
Yeah. Bucks Lake. We stopped for lunch here.
Okay. Yeah.
So we might have done
that one, maybe. Okay. Yeah. What route is that?
We cut over from
162. That's it. Yeah, the 162. That one was great. And then we went down by Truckee, and we went up and over a bunch of fucking random mountains. I don't remember. And then we were on the Donner Lake or Donner Pass or whatever it was. That whole forest, that Plumas National Forest, I'd never been there. It was spectacular driving.
Yeah, I'd never been there before.
Sort of in the northeast corner of California.
I'm trying to find where we crossed over, because I thought we were on the 70 for a while, and then we jumped over to Bucks for lunch and stuff. But this whole area was
That entire ridiculous. National Forest was absolutely incredible. Ridiculous. Yeah, that was nice. Any more before we gets out of here's? Zach? Thank you. And how is married life in the Delica? The Delica works pretty good.
Yeah.
It does.
I'm laughing because it's like, how's married life? It was like a 50s Friars Club. The Delica's working fine.
Yeah.
My wife, but
yeah. No, my wife is unemployed. And at first she was very stressed out about it, and now she's really leaning into it. now she's fucking chilling. The Delica works great.
She's consulting now.
Yeah, she got a couple freelance consulting gigs, which is nice.
Cool.
It was good. And she's had a few interviews. She'll be fucking fine. The Delica works great. It's slow, but it's fun. I'm taking it in for a service on Monday. I want to have the trans fluid checked, and you actually can't check it from in the fucking van. You have to do it from underneath.
Yeah.
So I need to have the trans fluid checked.
Belt.
We're going to do the timing belt because it's an interference engine, and we don't know when, if ever, it was done.
Probably never.
Wait, what's an interference engine?
An interference engine is if the timing belt snaps, the valves and shit smash into the pistons. Whereas if you have a non-interference engine, you could snap the timing belt and the engine will stall, but it won't launch itself.
Yeah, the pistons and valves are timed in such a way that they'll never touch as long as the timing is right. But the minute something's off...
The clearance is that tight.
The valves will stay open and the piston will hit the valve and it gets a hold. It's a huge big mess.
It's a big problem. That's so if you have an interference engine and you don't know about your timing belt... You have to get the timing belt done so you know it was done at this.
Usually 100,000 miles. But in this case, the truck's 30 years old. I mean, even though the mileage is really low, it's still 30-year-old rubber.
Right.
I'm not super worried about it because in between when I bought it and in between when I took delivery, somebody put 3,000 kilometers on it and it didn't blow up, so I'm okay. But yeah, we're going to do the timing belt. We're going to have the transfluid tested, transfluid checked and possibly changed, and we are going to repair the speedometer, which stopped working a couple days ago out of nowhere. I don't know why. Probably something very
Are you going to off-road up like Rower Flats or something just to see?
I don't give a fuck. people have asked me, like, when are you going to off-road? And like, there are zero things to me that are appealing about off-roading a 30-year-old vehicle that I care about.
Yeah.
If I'm going off-roading a 30-year-old car, it's going to be for All Cars Go to Heaven 3, and the car ain't coming back alive.
And it's going to be this.
Yeah. No, the Delica I bought is for Hannah and for my business. It's the airport shuttle for Westside Collector.
Protect your investment.
Yes. Right. And I'm going to leave us with one thing. Yeah, that's me getting climb out of the roof at Kogi. A lot of people have been asking me recently car advice, and I'm more than happy to give car advice. I love doing that. It's like a thing that I'm good at and that I'm into. But they've been going about it wrong, and I want to be helpful, but people aren't helping me help them. And the questions have gotten increasingly more absurd. Like, should I buy a Boxster or a Civic Type R, or maybe I'll just LS swap an FD RX-7, or maybe a monster truck? What do you think? I mean, today I got one that was like, I'm looking at a Corvette, I'm looking at a brand new Corvette, a 10-year-old Porsche, a 5-year-old M3, or an Audi A3, or an Audi A7. Like, what am I supposed to do with that? And I was thinking about, like, why that's such a ridiculous question. And it's such a ridiculous question because cars are not better than other cars. They're just better for you. And if you were to put those questions into the context of food, I thought about this on the treadmill earlier. What I want you to say is, Matt, I feel like eating a hamburger tonight. Who makes the best hamburger?
Yeah.
I want to go there. But instead, you're coming to me and saying, Matt, should I get a hamburger or curry? Or maybe, should I become a vegan?
How about just that's a Snickers bar? Maybe just get a Snickers bar and I'll call it a
that's
day.
That's how this question sounds. Should I eat a burger or become a vegan? That's how related a Corvette is to a 10-year-old 911 to an Audi A7.
It has to go back to, like we talked, that these are, you're asking, what experience do I want to have behind the wheel?
Mm-hmm.
And you need to narrow it down to letting us know, what is it you're trying to accomplish? You know, do you strictly want, you know, this specific, like, say, I want this experience. I need what's the best truck to tow in? What's the best thing I can do this with? There's different reasons, but like you said, to get that broad of a choice, you're not thinking about what is the experience that you're looking for to buy. You need to narrow that down before you ask, whether it's us or any other car guy or even just on your own.
Yeah.
If you're shopping for a car, you're shopping for a purpose. You're either shopping for transportation, you're shopping for a track car, you're shopping for a specific experience. And the experience may be just a daily. Maybe you need something with good gas mileage, just going to be comfy and has satellite radio or whatever. But you need to think about the experience that you want to have while behind the wheel of that car, and then...
And then I'll tell you who does that experience best. But like, you know, it's like, do I want to eat a steak or do I want ice cream?
I'm going to go on vacation. Do I go see to Egypt or do I maybe go scuba diving? What do you think?
I don't know.
Do you like water? I don't know. It's just, how's the heat?
Should I get a Gregory backpack? Yeah. A Louis Vuitton bag or just cargo plane? Like, how much stuff do you have?
Yeah. Or maybe should I just grab a bag from Ralph's?
Extra storage.
I don't want this to be like a me bitching segment, but help me help you. And if you if you email me or message me on Instagram or whatever, like, I want to help you. But
think about what it is you're trying to accomplish.
I need you to tell me the experience that you actually want to have. And furthermore, please... remember that test driving a vehicle is an option for you. There's ways you can go to places and test drive cars.
CarMax.
And a lot of people who ask me the question of do I want a hamburger or curry or become vegan? They are doing that before they've even driven any of this shit.
Yeah.
And so they don't know what experience they want because they don't know what experience is available. So like what you should do is watch my videos or somebody's videos or whatever to get a sense of what that experience is
for you.
For you. Yeah. Decide if the experience I'm having matches the experience you want to have from the video. And if not, ask me how you can get the best of that experience.
I always use a story. I had a buddy of mine who bought a car and he commuted a lot. And he had a specific system in the morning. He would get in the car. He would go get his coffee. His coffee would go here. His phone would go there. And he had this system. And he bought this new car. It's the car he always wanted. And he ordered it. Never drove it. Whatever. And he went to get in it like the first week. And it like he couldn't put his phone where he normally put it. And it sounds silly. Like, okay, we'll just get something else. But that was his system. That's, you know, he had this way of doing things every morning that the coffee cup wouldn't fit in the cup holder just right. This phone wouldn't. He didn't have a place to put his phone where he could see it. And it drove him insane.
Yeah, people's specifics.
And I tell people like, and it, you know, when normal people ask us, you know, I want to get a car. What do I? I was like, look, take it to the grocery store that you normally go grocery shopping. See about parking it. Take it home. If you have kids, put your car seat in it. Put your bag that you would take to work in it. Like you normally go through the motions of what being, if this is a daily, you know, obviously, if this is something that you're going to use a little bit more often, go through the motions of living with that car as much as humanly possible during the test drive, because chances are there may be a switch somewhere, like for instance, you know, the Cadillacs. If not having a volume knob for me drives me completely batshit insane.
Yeah.
But
yeah, like I'm a non-customer of those cars because I don't have a scroll knob. Like, I don't care how good that car is.
Some people don't care. I mean, you know, for a track car, who cares, whatever. But for something you're going to spend some time in.
Well, everyone has their own priorities.
Yeah.
Some people value steering feel over side bolstering. Other people go, I like the color.
The point is, think about that stuff before you ask us.
Yeah. Yeah, that's all. That's all. That's our show. Let's see, today's Tuesday, right?
It is.
So tomorrow's Wednesday, which means we have Chris motherfucking Porter coming in.
Yeah.
Nice.
Chris Porter's coming in tomorrow. He is a hilarious comic. I don't even know what he knows about cars, but he literally commented on my Instagram, and I've seen his sets, and I've seen his special, and I am thrilled that this guy wants to spend even fucking 5 minutes with me.
I may come in just to hang.
You should, because he's hilarious. He rules. Go check out his special tonight, Ugly and Angry. Does he have a new special since then? He may have a new special since then. I don't know. That's the one I saw before, and it was hilarious. And I strongly recommend. A Man from Kansas is the other one. What's the other one called?
Yeah, A Man from Kansas. The Sun is Bullshit. So maybe that looks. Maybe I don't know which one's newer.
That one is newer. Yeah, Ugly and Angry is from a couple years ago. But fuck me, is it great? And he's going to be here tomorrow, 5:00 Pacific time. So join us again live. All right, everyone, follow Vinny Russo 1 on Instagram so you can see his Cadillac. Zach Clapman is going to be editing my P. Cody videos, so we've got those coming out soon. Road and Track P. Cody is in the November issue, I think. And I don't know. That's all I got. We got more to talk about tomorrow. So that's it. You need your car kept safe and warm and snuggled in L.A.? Westside Collector Car Storage has you covered in Playa Vista, just 1.5 miles north of LAX. I got you. It's my place, bitch. And there it is, animated. I can't wait to have real pictures of a real building. But one of the greatest joys of this project has been to look at the rendering and go, fuck, the building looks just like it.
Yeah, it's cool.
So that's cool. All right, guys, the Smoking Tire Podcast is powered by Shout Engine. Get your own podcast at shoutengine.com. It's easy. All you need is a microphone, a connection to the internet, and ideally something to say. 5:00 Wednesday, tomorrow. We will see you then. Good evening.